Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. Ladies and gentlemen, today is a Tuesday and we are chilling like villains and we are continuing our conversation around the dynamics of preference versus standards. And the reason that we are talking about this is because I would like for us to start the year off knowing exactly what we're doing, why we're doing what we're doing, and how we're doing what we're doing about what we're doing. And then we do, and then we do the things that need to be done. So, ladies and gentlemen, alrighty. So we were talking about preference, and so today is a continuation of that. So we said that preference is personal likes, habits and, you know, desires, likes and dislikes and, certain desires that a person usually has. So, preferences in a relationship are a person's likes, habits and desires that influence partners' choices and interactions. So the types of preferences that we might have are physical preference, personality preference, lifestyle preference, and the last one was activities. You know, so we put everything together and we spoke about that. And now, there was the conversation or the dynamics between preferences versus standards. So now preferences, ladies and gentlemen, are all negotiable. Preferences are negotiable. Preferences are not written in stone. Preferences are things that maybe you can live without. So it's one of those things of, you might say that you really, really, really want, right? A tall guy. But if a short guy comes along and you are feeling each other, you might give it a chance, you know? So that means it is negotiable as long as the person is ultimately the nicest person. Standards, on the other hand, is reliability, respect, and certain attributes of this person must be like this. Otherwise, it's a deal breaker for you. So standards are usually things that are deal breakers, like, or like non-deal breakers, like, woo. For example, religion. So you might be a hardcore Christian and this person might be a hardcore atheist, or even worse, or not worse, but even the opposite. They are hardcore Satanists and they are absolutely great people, but they are Satanists. So for you, it might be a standard that I'm not getting onto the dark side. No matter how nice you are, no matter how I felt you, no matter how I like you, no matter how I'm feeling the boy, you know, I'm not doing that. And that's a standard. But then if you find that, you are a hardcore Christian and this person is a hardcore Satanist, but then you don't care about that, then it's not a standard. It might just be a preference. Then it might just be something that you prefer. You would have preferred a good Christian boy, but if he's not a good Christian boy, it's also not a deal breaker, and you're also not going to die simply because this boy is not a good Christian boy. So it continues like that. So that's the difference between a preference and a standard, because a preference in itself is something that you prefer, and a standard is something that is non-negotiable. Now, key considerations when it comes to relationships and when it comes to the concept of preference and standards, right, is compatibility. Compatibility number one. We're going to go down a list, ladies and gents. We're going to go down a list and then we're going to see exactly how it might relate to you. So compatibility. Preferences help find someone compatible, but shared core values, standards, are vital for longevity. So that's the difference now between preference and standards, right? Because with preference, it helps you find somebody that is compatible to you. And then with standards, this is how you guys stay together. So sometimes we can say physical, the physical attributes of this person is usually what would make you feel like, oh no, you guys are compatible, right? And, you can say now that, oh no, like from the physical side that this is nice. I like this. And then from talking to them, you know, their personalities, oh, this is what I like. And then we get to the type of standards that you had set, right? And these types of standards are now the things like respect and how they are raised and, I don't know what denomination they come from or what ethnicity they are. Those are the things that keep you guys together, right? Because maybe if you're a person that loves mutual respect and you guys are giving each other mutual respect, then that is what gives it longevity, and that is how compatibility in itself is formed, or compatibility in itself is tested. And communication, clearly stating your own preferences without dictating your partner's is crucial. So you can't dictate somebody else's preferences. You can't say like, yeah, but you have to prefer me. Or like, yeah, I don't understand why you don't prefer me. Like, yeah, I don't understand why you don't prefer that. Like, oh, I don't understand. You can't dictate somebody else's preferences because they are not you and you are not them. So the best way to go about it is to just look at yourself. And I think that that's the beauty of starting a relationship, right? Because you are not obligated to feel anything for this person except those little butterflies and those little what-whats that come in the beginning. You are not really obligated to... You're not obligated to stay with this person. You're not obligated to be in a relationship with this person. You're not obligated to do anything. And that is why it's so vital for many of us to really scrutinize what we're doing in these relationships and what type of relationships we want from the get-go, so that we don't get trapped into situations where we can't get out of them and we can't do without them. You understand? So it is so much better for us to take it upon ourselves, you know, to look at things from a perspective of, let me not try and change you. Let me see what you are so that I can decide whether or not you are for me or you are not for me. Instead of, oh, I like you so much and I'm just going to change you into what I want you to be. Then you are never going to be truly compatible, because you changed the person. You made the person who you want them to be. So one day when you find them drinking upleki, yeah, you find them drinking upleki, you're like, oh, I just never thought a woman can do that. Why? Why did you think that? Because the first time you met me, I was drinking that. And that's what I find weird, when you want somebody to change, but yet when you guys met, this is exactly what they were doing. And you just thought it was a fling or a fluke, or it was something that was passing by, but it actually isn't, because it's actually their lives and their reality. And you can't dictate their preferences. You can't say like, yeah, you must prefer me even if I'm a tall guy. You must prefer me because all women prefer me, because tall guys are usually preferred. Yeah, but I don't prefer them. Tall guys are usually preferred by others. So maybe you should go to others that prefer those ones. But personally for me, I like them, you know, whatever. You tell the person that I like them short and I like them, you know, stubby and num 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 num. Maybe that's your thing, right? Maybe that's what you like. Maybe that's what gets the motor going. You know, that's what you like. So maybe, just maybe. And this is why we talk about, we say that you can't dictate it. You can't dictate somebody's preferences. And the beginning of a relationship is usually something that is, it's a window. It's a window opportunity for you to really see things for what they are. But before that, ladies and gentlemen, Andia Twepi, PBND.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. Mm. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past. Mm. And it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Alrighty. Ladies and gentlemen, the reason that we're talking about preferences and standards is that I feel that many of us have played ourselves in so many ways when it comes to relationships. And part of the really, really honestly playing ourselves, right, is not understanding the difference between the two. It's not understanding that something is a preference and that is something that I'm willing to compromise. And something that's a standard is also something that I'm not willing to compromise. It's non-negotiable. It is what it is. So if you are going to be, if you are a tall, thick woman, right, and that is my type, I'm not going to compromise on the fact that I'm into tall, thick women. I can't. If you become now, all of a sudden, you become this slender, extremely slender chick, you know, and you are now a tall, slender chick. Now I add something on you, a tall, slender, lighting complexion chick, all of a sudden, because now I can see your complexion and it's a thing now, and it becomes something. Those are the things that I'm talking about. I'm talking about differentiating between standards and preferences, so that maybe, just maybe, we would understand more the people that we end up with, so that maybe, just maybe, we can avoid being in situations where we are stuck with people for the rest of our lives that don't really get it, that don't iron out things. So, ladies and gentlemen, we are jumping into our first therapy session today with Esther Perel. And we are talking about be careful who you marry, or we are listening to be careful who you marry. And we are taking from that, from the same concept of preference and standards and how it plays a role. So please do feel free to call in. The number in studio is 083-288-401. If you would also like to participate in a conversation of this nature.
This notion sometimes that people have, that you have to know yourself first, you have to love yourself first, you know, and then you can go and be in a relationship, never made sense to me. Because you only know yourself through your interactions with others. The way I speak is influenced by the way you listen. The way I see myself is influenced by the way you see me. We are not just one person. We may have core characteristics, But we are shaped by the relationship in which we are. We make the relationship, and the relationship makes us.
Esther, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure for me to be here.
Yeah, me too. Look, we've had about 10 minutes of background stress trying to connect over Skype and then Zoom, which in many ways is the way of the new world in which we're living, right?
Yes, the tech meltdown is the new intro.
I have been wanting to interview you for many years now. I love, like many people, love your work, your ideas. And so really grateful for you giving me some time today. First of all, to put a context for people, where are we having this conversation? I'm in my house in South Manchester in England. How about yourself?
I am in Woodstock, New York, where I have been confined since March.
Welcome to the Huberman Lab podcast, where we discuss science and science-based tools for everyday life. I'm Andrew Huberman, and I'm a professor of neurobiology and ophthalmology at Stanford School of Medicine. My guest today is Esther Perel. Esther Perel is a psychotherapist and one of the world's foremost experts on romantic relationships. She's also the author of best-selling books such as Mating in Captivity and The State of Affairs. Today's discussion focuses on what it means to be in a truly functional romantic relationship. We discuss this from the standpoint of identity, that is, how people both try to hold on to and evolve their identities within a relationship, and how a truly functional romantic relationship indeed evolves over time from a standpoint of curiosity and adventure, but also one in which people need to hold on to certain components of themselves. We explore what conflict in relationships looks like and the dynamics that underlie those conflicts. So focusing less on specific scenarios, but rather the dynamics that exist in conflicts in romantic relationship across all different situations and different combinations of people. And of course, we also talk about what healthy conflict resolution looks like, what a truly effective apology looks and sounds like, and we explore the erotic aspects of relationships, comparing and contrasting, for instance, love and desire, how sometimes those things run in parallel in the same direction, how sometimes those run in opposite directions, and how people can explore their own notions, their own models of love and desire in order to have more effective romantic relationships. By the end of today's episode, you will learn from the world's foremost expert on romantic relationships, how to find, build, and revive romantic relationships that feel most satisfying to all partners involved. I'm also pleased to announce that Esther Perel has just released a new course on intimacy. You can find a link to that course in the show note captions, as well as links to her books, her podcast, and other resources about romantic relationships. Before we begin, I'd like to emphasize that this podcast is separate from my teaching and research roles at Stanford. It is, however, part of my desire and effort to bring zero cost to consumer information about science and science-related tools to the general public. In keeping with that theme, I'd like to thank the sponsors of today's podcast. Our first sponsor is David. David makes a protein bar unlike any other. It has 28 grams of protein, only 150 calories, and 0 grams of sugar. That's right, 28 grams of protein, and 75% of its calories come from protein. This is 50% higher than the next closest protein bar. These bars from David also taste incredible. My favorite bar is the cake-flavored one, but then again, I also like the chocolate-flavored one, and I like the berry-flavored one. Basically, I like all the flavors. They're all incredibly delicious. Now, for me personally, I try to get most of my calories from whole foods. However, when I'm in a rush, or I'm away from home, or I'm just looking for a quick afternoon snack, I often find that I'm looking for a high-quality
Find ourselves, and we meet an other and want to be surprised by the self we haven't known. I think that all of us come into this world with a fundamental set of dual needs. We need security and we need freedom and adventure. And we need togetherness and we need separateness. So in the relationship, you come in order to create that identification, but also that differentiation. It's a dialectic all the time. But what's interesting is even if I choose you, because you represent sometimes the parts of me that are more challenging or that I disavow or that I prefer to outsource so I don't have to be too vulnerable about them,
what draws me to you in the beginning, because it is different, that I think may expand me and make me change, is also the very thing that becomes the source of conflict later, because we want to change, but up to a point, not too much and not on your terms. So we want change, but we sometimes are afraid of change. And so we let the other person represent the part of us that would want to change, but then we disconnect from it. So you become the representative of that. I am drawn to the fact that you are stable, grounded, structured, solid, reliable, on time, you name it. I know that this is something that I would like to be more of. And
I am drawn to. You see how Esther talks about I am drawn to. I am drawn to is something that, woo, I like this. Oh, it's not that I can't live without a person that is on time and they are what and they are what. I feel like, oh, I would prefer somebody that is like this, because then that would surely rub off on me a little bit. You understand? You understand.
Just a very simple example. But then I start to think of you as rigid because I get a little more than what I bargained for. And now I start to argue with your rigidity and my desire to actually become more structured and solid and punctual and reliable has somehow disappeared.
So if I understand correctly, we seek out others in order to try and initiate the process of change that we want.
Right.
But then when we hit the friction point, meaning the point where it challenges where we are,
that's right,
then there's a form of resent or frustration. The reason
defensiveness.
Defensiveness.
Yes. You know what it is? Every system straddles stability and change, and then grapples for homeostasis. Every relationship goes through that. Every system in nature goes through that. But the same thing is true inside an individual. We want change and we need stability. And then these things sometimes are compensating each other and they are complementary, and at times they butt heads.
So a very practical question.
Yeah.
Then what are the necessary but not sufficient elements that somebody should have in themselves before they go seeking a romantic relationship? Meaning, what is necessary in order to be able to embark on the process with any chance of success, barring, you know, extreme pathology, right? Assuming that both people entering the relationship have the best of intentions to make the relationship work, in quotes.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it both a sense of one's own identity as well as what specifically they would like to change? Or is it some other, you know, constellation of factors?
Different ways to answer this. You know, I think sometimes people say I want to be with you because you helped me become the best version of myself.
Yeah, you hear that a lot.
And so what is that version? You know, who is it that I want to see that I think you will help me become? When you talk about these romantic relationships, first of all, I think there's a different answer if we're talking about cornerstone relationships or capstone relationships. Do you know the concept?
If you don't mind defining those,
right.
For the audience.
Right, so the cornerstone relationship is where when we used to meet in our early 20s, and together we build the foundation of our relationship. We grew together. We saved our first monies together. We got our first places together, etc. It was very much foundational. Capstone is the foundation has already been established because we tend to meet at this point 10, 12 years later. So during those 12 years, I've already actually worked, so to speak, on my identity. I have defined myself, my values, my aspirations, my constructs, how I want to see my life. And when I meet you, you're a confirmation for all of this. You're a confirmation of what I've already built. And I am putting you and me as the capstone, which we put on top of what we've already created. You and me, you've done the same thing. So I am looking for someone who recognizes my identity, not for someone who helps me develop my identity from much earlier age. So there's a developmental arc that changes the mandate. I said it's both, but the priority of if it's the building of identity or the expansion of that identity, what you call change, differs if you meet somebody when you're young and if you meet somebody when you're in your 30s.
What happens when people are mismatched in terms of age?
I mean, there is a big age differences a lot of the time. And in gay relationships, you have often a major age difference that means something else, but it creates differentiation. In straight relationships, you often have men who are a lot older than the women, very much rooted in evolutionary biology, I think, and fertility. But and now we have more and more a new phenomenon of older women with younger men, but that's actually been very rare in most cultures.
So that's shifting now towards more often people are observing older women with younger men?
You know, when you have four movies at this moment that are talking about this, then you begin to see the crescent of a new cultural phenomenon. I think the fact that it appears in the arts and in the culture usually announces something. I wouldn't make it yet a phenomenon. Mm-hmm. But you asked me a question before about what are the things people need. I mean, you know, when you embark any relationship, I tend to think as both end on a lot of things. I come to you with a certain self-awareness. How much self-awareness, the more there is, the better. And that self-awareness, I think, as its best translates in a sense of, I think a good vow to say at the time of your wedding is, I'll fuck up on a regular basis and on occasion I'll acknowledge it. It means that a self-awareness comes with a self-knowledge about your limitations, your ability to take responsibility for it without blame and shame, and basically accountability. I think accountability is an enormous component of relationship. It's okay. We all do things. You know, we all have our wounds and our frustrations and our expectations and our unexpressed needs and our unfulfilled longings, etc. But it's a good thing to know it and to admit it and to not pretend that it's not me, but it's you. You know, I often say that couples therapy, I am a practicing couples therapist for almost 40 years, and couples often come to therapy thinking that you're a drop-off center. You know, they come to deliver their problem, and their problem is their partner. And you're going to fix it. And they're going to help you because they're an expert on what's wrong with the partner. And it's an amazing thing how people have tremendous insight on all the shortcomings of the other person and do not see themselves as part of a system. A relationship is a breathing, living system of interdependent parts.
Do you think that's perhaps one reason why people who are in these cornerstone relationships, of whom I've known many, you know, even family members of mine, you know, met in university, met their significant other, and then had their first jobs, moved in together, all the things you describe, that there's this...
They grow up together.
Yeah, and I think it probably happens at a stage of life when there's still a lot more neuroplasticity, frankly. I mean, everything I know about neuroplasticity is that it exists across the lifespan, but that it tapers off significantly in one's late 20s.
Right.
And, you know, fortunately, it's still available, but the notion of being set in our ways is a neuroplasticity phenomenon,
yes,
right?
It's the closing of the prefrontal cortex.
Pretty much.
The fontanelli still.
Exactly. It takes a lot more to open that plasticity later than it does earlier, certainly. And yet it's inversely related to the self-awareness, right? I mean, the younger we are, the less self-aware we are about our patterns because we just have less data over time. So I could see how it would be more difficult for somebody in their 20s to say, hey, listen, I think I have a good many virtues, but I have this severe issue with something, or this particularly frustrates me, or here's my laundry list of issues, right? Whereas somebody in their 40s or 50s or older, if pressed, could probably make that list if they were really being honest with themselves. So it seems like...
I think it's a good point.
You know, so it seems that there's a sweet spot, but that these earlier relationships, I've always been impressed by them and kind of romanticized them in my mind because that wasn't the trajectory that I took.
But they have a challenge. You see, when you grow up together, you often put a lot of energy into the building of the unit. Mm-hmm. And that unit then is supposed to become your base, your scaffolding from which two individuals can begin to grow and to define themselves. When you meet later, you are already two individuals that have defined themselves who now have to find a way to create the energy to come together. So it's a different movement. It's a different choreography. I think that the challenge for young couples today who meet early in college and have known often only themselves and a few people in their teenage years, etc., or none, is what happens when they begin to change individually. Can the relationship expand enough to broaden the envelope to let these two people, you know, emerge individually, or is the jacket too tight? Is the vest too tight? And often that it becomes a bit of a crisis. It's because they grew together by on the basis of this togetherness. And sometimes they can, and sometimes it just feels like, is this that in order to become adults, it may need to happen with a different partner. And that's why I always say, I think this moment we have two or three relationships or marriages in our adult lives in the West. And some of us will do it with the same person, but the relationship has to change. It's like the person changes the relationship, but the relationship makes room for the person to change. This is dynamic.
If that just feels like such a true statement to me, because in my professional life as a developmental neurobiologist, there's a saying, people always think of development and then adulthood, but all of life is one big developmental arc.
That's absolutely correct.
And the great psychologist Erickson spoke about the different sort of challenges that people face from birth all the way until death, which, you know, nowadays hopefully will extend into people's 80s, 90s, or even beyond.
Well, his last stage is the generative stage. Mm-hmm. It's actually an amazing, I mean, he's the most articulate theoretician of stages of life.
I agree. If people haven't seen those stages, we'll put a link to them in the show note captions. Yeah. But the idea is that you're basically grappling with some basic struggle that you either reconcile or you don't at every stage. So you could imagine that these three marriages, let's imagine a couple that meets in their 20s and does three marriages, which implies a couple divorces in between, mm-hmm. maybe not legal divorces, across their lifespan. They really are, according to the Erickson theory of development or any neurobiological examination of brain development, different people in their 20s versus 40s versus 60s, 70s, 80s. So this notion of three different marriages to me seems both logical and very grounded in what we know about the biology of the brain and the self. So
good metaphor is rooted in science.
and yet it's also kind of a radical idea when one hears it for the first time. If framed in the context of with the same person, it sounds kind of lovely and romantic. Okay, they meet, it's lovely, they have their first marriage. Then there's some challenge, they overcome, they do a second marriage. Then some challenge and a third marriage. And maybe there's even grandchildren, you imagine, maybe even great-grandchildren. There's all this kind of romantic notions built up around it. But then there's also the reality that for many people, more than half, there's a fracture of the first marriage and that they either remain single or marry again. And so what do you think dictates whether or not a person can go through these series of evolutions and actually find and create love again and again and again, either with the same person or with someone new, or in some cases, I guess, three different partners? I mean, what is the sort of requirement? Is it a willingness to accept this model and understand that who they are at 50 is going to be very different than who they were in their 20s?
You know, a good question is a question that has many answers. There's different ways to answer this. I think that more than thinking about it as they were able to overcome crises, it's really the ability to redefine oneself and to redefine a relationship. It's much more creative than problem solving. You can overcome a crisis and put it aside and stay the same. This is much more of a generative experience. It's a creative experience, is that you actually become a different unit. The power dynamic is different. The interdependence is different. The erotic charge is different. The connection to the outside world is different. It's really enlivening. I think everybody understands the difference between a relationship that is not dead and a relationship that is alive. I am not there to help people survive. My work is about more than that. It's about helping people to feel alive. And the redefinition of having the same relationship with the same person, it has to be alive, not just not dead. And if sometimes that alive means recreating a new, you know, going to a new person, a new country, a new city, a new social circle, a new profession, a new, a lot of things that we today have access to change, things that people did once. You know, when I ask an audience, if your grandparents grew up in the same neighborhood or in the same town and worked in the same company, I mean, most people raise their hands. And then I go down the generations, and then now it's like, how many of you have had three jobs in the last 5 years? So this notion that we can create new things for ourselves is actually one of the greatest things that has happened in the realm of relationships. We can have kids much later. We can join somebody who has already had those children. We can marry in our 60s for the first time. We can live in a threesome. We can, there's a plasticity, if you want to use a word that to the world of relationship today, that is extremely rich and expansive, but demands a set of skills to negotiate, to understand the uncertainty that comes from having to make so many decisions at a time with, in the past, none of us made decisions about most of these things. They were handed down to us. So that level of freedom is utterly rich, but comes with a tremendous amount of anxiety and demands maturity. And sometimes couples have become so entrenched and so locked in their story and confusing their story with the truth and feeling that they're living next to someone who has a completely different version of the story that they cannot talk to. Like, there is no greater polarization sometimes than a couple that once agreed on a lot of things, that you just think there's no way change can enter this system.
Okay, so when I hear your answer, what comes to mind is that, again, as a neurobiologist, I think the brain, the human brain, has this amazing capacity to focus on past, present, or future. And sometimes two of those three things, it's kind of hard to think about all three at once. But it sounds to me as if one of the more functional attributes that somebody can have if they want to navigate relationship in a healthy way is to be able to at least temporarily discard with one's story about one's past and even their past identity. And the word that was coming up over and over again in my mind as you answered was this word you used earlier, which was curiosity. And I'm wondering if what you're referring to is a curiosity on the part of hopefully both people in the relationship as to what the relationship could become and who oneself could become. And my definition of curiosity is an interest in finding out, but without an emotional attachment to what the outcome is. This is what we train scientists to mm-hmm. do. You want to get the answers, but you can't get emotionally attached to the answer being A or B. That's anti-curiosity. Real, genuine curiosity is about the process, the verb action of wanting to figure out something, but not being attached to a particular outcome. And as you were describing sort of functional trajectory of relationship, I was thinking, okay, so if one could approach relationship with a willingness to discard kind of stories about one's past and maybe even a sense of one's identity of past, be willing to let go of that a little bit and just be curious about like, where could this go if I let the relationship guide my evolution of identity a bit? And that takes some, as you said, some boldness, because if it's kind of scary, right? If you not knowing who one is going to become, if they let the other person, you know, maybe lead for a while or if they were to lead for a while. Are these the sorts of dynamics that you're referring to?
I think you almost articulated one of the most important pieces of my work. I mean, curiosity is one of the top words for me because it stands in opposition to reactivity. Reactivity reinforces the cycle. It just creates narrow repetition, rapid, you know, cycles of escalation. It usually involves defense and attack and blame, etc. Curiosity is an active engagement with the unknown. And I like when you say without the attachment to the outcome or the emotional investment. I think that's absolutely accurate. And Much of what I do is try to have people switch from reactive to curious. But that curiosity means that they're willing to enter empathically and respectfully into the realm of another person whose narrative is completely different. I'm very invested and familiar with the neurosciences and the whole work on the brain in relationships, but I am very interested in narrative because I believe that the story shapes the experience. And when people hold on to the story and they don't think it's a story, they think it's fact. This is what happened last night. I'll tell you what you did. I'll tell you what happened. You know, that's not the case, you know, and they don't see this as a subjective rendering. It's totally valid, but it's valid as your experience. And much of couples' conversations is pseudo-factual talk, but it is actually subjective. Once you get that, you can become curious. Once you are curious, you open up. But it is very challenging when people are hurt, wounded, defensive, holding tight to invite that curiosity. It's what's happening in their bodies is about shutdown and defense and self-protection. And you want, I'm doing this physically to you because you, this is where the brain and the neurobiology in that moment is going against what actually is in their best interest psychologically and existentially.
I'd like to take a quick break and acknowledge our sponsor, AG1. AG1 is a vitamin mineral
bring two opposing parties, factions, tribes, you know, who have been in conflict and at war for a long time, and how do you bring them together? There's actually a method, a process. It's not written in stone, but, you know, you certainly don't start by talking about the things that drive you completely apart and unable to talk to each other. You start by finding some elements of your shared humanity. In a couple, because that is the space we talk about now, in a couple, it's an incredible thing how people can literally think that the other person wants their demise. You live day in, day out with someone who you really think wants to hurt you, is your enemy. And sometimes there is evil, you know, there's people who don't have good intentions, but in many situations, it's also a projection. It's also experiences that you've had in the past. And this is where what's interesting is that the narrative, the conscious narrative lives here. And what you call the brain that can only locate itself in three temporal, and the brain and the physiology are in a different time. Implicit memory is completely influencing explicit narrative.
Yep. People are incredibly prone to confabulation based on these unconscious things going on. And it's kind of a scary thought.
If I feel it, this is what's happening.
That's right. Right.
And because we are creatures of meaning, we need to reconcile those things and we need coherence in our narratives. And that coherence is what is so difficult for when you work with people who are what is it that they're holding on to? I mean, you know, one of the classic examples is someone says, I'm really sorry, I didn't mean to. And the other one says, that's not the case. You know, like if someone tells you, I didn't mean to hurt you, you would think that someone would say, ah, that's reassuring. I like to hear that. I hope that's true. Makes me feel a lot better. Rather than proving to you that that's not true. You wanted to step on my toes. You intentionally put those heels on or those shoes or those fists to step on me. And that coherence of maintaining the idea that if I feel that you hurt me, you must have been wanting to hurt me, rather than, you know, I can be hurt and that doesn't mean you intentionally were trying to do anything. It's as if I need to justify my being hurt by the intention of what you did. And to just make sure, sometimes that's the case. Mm-hmm. It's not that there are not people who intentionally want to hurt some people. But at other times, what I'm highlighting is that the coherence to make sense of why I'm feeling this way demands that I also define what you are trying to do to me.
I mean, and in reality, Most people are terrible at understanding how they themselves feel, let alone someone else's intentions. I mean, if somebody apologizes and says, listen, I'm truly sorry, I screwed up. And the other person says, I don't believe you. I think what they're really saying, you can tell me if I'm wrong, is I don't feel better as a consequence of your apology.
That's because your apology, I screwed up, is incomplete. Most of the time, people say that I made a mistake, I'm sorry, but it doesn't acknowledge what the other person felt in response to what we did.
So let's say that the apology also includes that I really messed up. It makes total sense that you would be upset. You know, we had an agreement that we would meet at 7 and I didn't get home until 9 and I didn't notify you until 8. I would be upset too. That's totally justified. That sucks. That's got to really suck. At that point, if the other person still feels like it's still frustrating, presumably it's because either this is a pattern. Mm-hmm. So this one apology doesn't encapsulate the sort of a litany of other things that relate to this, of feeling unseen or unappreciated, or, you know, there's often a lot more behind the event.
You've apologized many times.
Right. It could be a pattern of apologies that don't equate to change, or it could be a pattern of an apology that, doesn't encapsulate all the other things that weren't voiced. Because sometimes people won't voice their grievances for whatever reason. But there's a lot of resentment that's built up, right? So in that moment when somebody tells another that they are not convinced, emotionally convinced, what are the tools that you give each in order to be able to navigate that sticking point?
I think apology is an amazing topic in the realm of relationship. It's a huge piece. Apology, forgiveness, ownership, responsibility, accountability, that whole range of things. I think if you give that apology many times, somebody, and it's not that you're doing this every Tuesday, the person will probably just say, thank you. If you have someone who can't receive an apology and the apology is sincere, that's the first and foremost thing that accompanies an apology, then you begin to ask, why is this person struggling to receive this? Because it is the thing that you should be getting. And then you start to ask yourself, is it because if I accept your apology, it's as if I agree that what you did wasn't so bad? It is repairable. And in order to really make clear that a grievance is big, I cannot receive your apology. That's one of the dynamics that often occurs in that moment. And so you ask sometimes, you sit and you see somebody who pretends to say, I'm sorry. You see somebody who just says, come on, what's the big deal? And then you see people who really are sincere. And then you watch what's happening to the other person. Are they relieved? Are they suspicious? Are they feeling like they would dissolve a certain element of their identity if they don't hold on to this? Is it as if they're saying, you can get away with it? It's not as bad, because accepting the apology is to minimize the issue. And then you switch the burden on the other side. In Judaism, you apologize 3 times. And if after the 3rd time, and you've done a real reckoning apology, if after the 3rd time the other person does not accept it, the burden passes over to the other person.
Interesting.
This is my money desk. And I think it's an incredibly interesting idea that at some point the person has made the amends, when they have. And when you cannot receive it, then now the burden passes on you.
I'm just going to hover there for a second, because I agree that apology is such an interesting and important concept. And you mentioned that accepting somebody's apology at an emotional level, not just saying, thank you, I accept your apology, but really internalizing that and allowing space for it to shift your experience of the thing that hurt.
And by the way, accepting the apology doesn't yet mean that you forgive. Forgive is your freedom. You decide at what point you do it, and you may do it alone. It's not always a dyadic experience. Apology is a dyadic experience, but forgiveness is freedom.
Yeah, I appreciate that distinction now that you've given it. I mean, I appreciate you giving that distinction. I did not make that distinction.
I love this
before.
Topic because it's mm-hmm. It's really so many things happen underneath. Mm-hmm. You know, there's issues of shame around apology. What's the difference between shame and responsibility? What is the capacity of a person to have real distress rather than empathic distress? Real empathy rather than empathic distress. And so it's a portal into a lot of things, you know. There are people who can never apologize.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Because to do so would what for them?
Shame. I think a lot of that piece is around shame. It's not, because self-esteem, as my friend Terry Real says, is your ability to see yourself as a flawed individual and still hold yourself in high regard. When you admit your flaw, it means there's something wrong with you. Then it's very hard to say, I'm sorry. This is the essence. How do you see yourself as imperfect? Flawed. But you still respect yourself and you hold yourself in high regard. If you can do those two things, you can apologize very easily.
I find that so much of being an adult, again, in quotes.
Yes, yes, you would hope.
involves the disambiguating two things. One is we're taught to really trust our own experience to some extent, to stand our ground when we know A is true and B is false. But then also part of being an adult is admitting when we're wrong. And there's no rule book, no real-time rule book for that, especially given that people have different versions of the same thing often. But it seems to me that one of the great challenges in not just in romantic relationship, but in relationships of all kinds is to really be able to slow down and enter the state of mind and body that allows us to do the kind of processing you're talking about. So at a very practical level, I'm curious, let's say a couple comes into your office and they're dealing with either a single hurt or a litany of hurts or something like that. Do you believe it's important for them to shift out of their emotional state to be able to process differently? Do you have them at the beginning of a session, do you have them do a couple deep breaths together? Do you have them recall a time when they felt particularly bonded? Is there an effort to shift their somatic state in order to bring their mind to a place of more curiosity? Or is going straight to the issue often the best way in?
First of all, I like that it's interesting, we're going from apology to conflict. It makes total sense. I spent the last year creating a whole course on conflict and how do you turn conflict into connection?
Beautiful.
What is good conflict? You know, I think conflict is inherent to relationships. Mm-hmm. And then what are problematic ways to deal with conflict? Yes, on some level, there is very little you can hear if you are in a state of hyperarousal. Mm-hmm. If you are in a position of self-protection, I mean, all these stressful places, all these cortisol levels going up, etc., are not going to help you. But at the same time, you can't, in the moment that someone is completely agitated, talk with them about trusting. I mean, it's just like the physiology is not corresponding. So it's a real dance. I don't do the breath often, sometimes. I mean, I actually don't do anything all the time. I am working like a tailor. I do fittings. I think the richness of therapy is in its art on some level. Let me be. But sometimes I just say, I think you need to stand up and move and just listen to what your partner has to say, but don't sit. Sometimes I say, don't look at each other. Sometimes I say, turn to each other. Some things are better done face to face and some things are better done side by side. You know, parallel play, fishing. There's a lot of things like you know, driving. Every parent who's ever had a kid in the back knows this. You have both. You have moments when you need to be able to look into each other, and you have moments where you just need to do this, something about the side by side. Then it's also the limits of words. When is it important to talk? And when, you know, we're talking because we are Homo sapiens, but in fact, if we were animals, we would be just making noises. We're not really making sense. Mm-hmm. So stop talking. Mm-hmm. So what I try very hard to do is to not let people show the worst side of themselves. They can do that at home. They don't need to come and shame themselves in my office. And I do know that certain situations will draw the worst out of people, but that doesn't mean that that's who they are. And that's one of the big things as a therapist, is to not fall for that. And just because if you met these people alone, they would be charming. And if you had met them maybe 2 years before, they would have been charming too. So something's happening between them that is making them act and react from places of deep hurt and fear and attack and all of that, and aggression. And sometimes I see them alone. I don't think that you are capable of having this conversation at this moment, because you're not willing to take any responsibility when you're sitting next to your partner. You're in a blame fest. And we're not going to do that. So I'm going to talk with you alone. And then I'm going to prepare you to come to your partner with at least one or two things that you can own. What am I doing to contribute to this mess? Or what am I doing to make things better? I like to start the session by asking, what did you, and if I'm dealing with a kind of chronic conflict, low intensity warfare, or bigger, it depends what kind, there's different kinds of conflict. But I like to ask, what have you done this week to make things better?
What a great question.
What have you done to make your partner feel that they matter? Rather than what happened this week. You know, I kind of have a sense. Please do not tell me the last unraveling. You know, I got it. It goes from 0 to 60 in no time. And none of this. I don't need the details of the story. I need to know what you're doing to each other, what feelings you're instigating in each other. I don't need the plot. The plot is, you know, there's only three dances. This fight, you know, aiming at each other, withdrawing from each other, or one person withdrawing and one person pursuing. These are three types of major choreographies of conflict. Or psst, quiet silence, or one goes after the other who is closing the doors and they follow them through the house, which is following them to a lot of other things. And from that place on, you decide, okay, who is doing what to whom? Who is feeling what at the hands of whom? What is influencing this? You know, this person is once again feeling that when this one didn't talk to them, they were being given the silent treatment that they used to feel when they grow up. This feeling of neglect and dismissal is just crushing them, because they suddenly feel like they've been rejected completely. And this one is feeling like they're once again being attacked and invaded by this other person who keeps following them and wants to talk when they have taken, and is remembering when they were living in the place where they grew up, where they couldn't wait to get out because they were feeling completely flooded and overwhelmed by the shit show of their house. And these two stories are now dictating what's happening between these two people. These two people are no longer adults in the room. Their younger selves have completely taken over. Their amygdala is completely flooded. And then it matters. It depends. Sometimes, because I'm a little bit narrative driven, I may make the mistake to actually go to the story when in fact these two people really put, sometimes I sit for 10 minutes quiet. I say, we're going to just wait for our systems to regulate, because even I get agitated. It's not like I don't absorb it. I say, I think we need some sitting here. Sometimes I put music. I love music, so I put music. You know, I just say, I don't think a single word is going to help here. And sometimes I say, I think we should stop the session. I mean, it depends. If you think there's something that can be gained, if you start to feel like it's just going to make it worse. And sometimes I, in the middle of the session, may say, when's the last time you made him a cup of tea? And the fact that you can still make a cup of tea to someone who you would like to strangle is really special. It's amazing how we can inhabit two completely contradictory feelings at the same time. I can't stand you. Get me the hell out of here. And I can't imagine my life without you. Those things coexist, love and hate, side by side.
I'd like to take a quick break and thank one of our sponsors, Function. Almost like we lose our theory of mind, our ability to place ourselves in the mind of another in a healthy way when we're in these stress states. I'm curious.
It's funny you call it stress states, because stress, to me, is so physiological that it doesn't include the relational component.
Sure.
I mean, there needs to be a word for stress that involves the emotional reality. And that emotional reality that now may be somewhat imagined, and this is why it's complicated, was once true. Mm-hmm. What now is an internal truth once was what really happened. And that's why we imagine, and this is how we interpret the dynamic. It's very important to add that. So the past was real. There was someone in the past who actually did this to me. But when you do this, I think of them, I bring those two things together. I collapse the past and the present. And that's why I'm convinced this is what you're doing to me too. And so how do you take somebody out of their physical and mental and emotional past to be grounding themselves into the present so that they can consider that this person that is next to them is not doing to them what once was done to them.
Right. And my mind immediately goes to what you just described as a shift from focusing mainly on the past and how it's making us feel in the present to how we're feeling in the present, acknowledging and understanding something did happen. That was real, as you said, and yet with this curious eye toward the future of what could unfold.
That's probably the hardest nugget of couples therapy. I mean, I do individual work too, but if we talk relational therapy, this is one of those nuggets, because people are not aware that they are in their past. They are convinced that this is in the present. It's a collapse of time zones and realities. It's what makes us so rich. It's what makes us so able to be creative and artful, but it's what sometimes makes it very challenging for us, especially in romantic relationships. Because you asked, at first you began with romantic relationships. A lot of what we say here is true for friendships and work relationships, but there is only two relationships that mirror each other. It's the one we had with our first caretakers, mostly our parents, and the ones we have with our romantic partners. People can sit in the office and tell you, I don't have this with anybody else. And it's true. Mm-hmm. Often. You believe them. Because nobody gets as close to you and nobody elicits in you the kinds of early yearnings and emotional needs than a romantic partner. And that is very interesting.
I don't know if it's a bug or a feature, as the engineers say, but it is remarkable to me that the very same neural machinery that forms the underpinning of infant primary caretaker relationship is repurposed for romantic relationship. I mean, I marvel at that.
Interesting.
Right? I mean, the brain doesn't have like, oh, here's your developmental wiring circuits. And then guess what? You get to hit adolescence and you go through puberty and then you get this new circuit for forming a romantic attachment.
Same one.
The brain imaging shows us that it's repurposed. So it's like if you got a 2+2=4 algorithm in that circuit, let's call that securely attached, although mm-hmm. I realize that language is not sufficient, but for just purposes mm-hmm. of discussion. Okay, well then great. Then you get healthy romantic attachments as adults, or you as an adult, and perhaps you can navigate in and out of things that are unhealthy more quickly. However, if you got a 2+2=5 algorithm wired into that circuit, well, then you're forever looking for something that won't that is essentially dysfunctional. That's the simplest version of this.
Tell me more about this repurposing. It's really interesting.
Yeah. So, beautiful work by Alan Shore and others has, whose work I know you're familiar with, has shown that, you know, you image the brain of infant and typically it's mother, but they've done other caretakers as well. And you see this incredible mirroring of, sure, right brain, left brain activity, more dopaminergic or serotonergic activity. Basically, the takeaway is that you see a lot of coherence. What's going on in the mother is going on in the child and vice versa. And it's there's a lot of reciprocity. But sometimes in unhealthy caretaker-infant relationships, the so-called anxious attached, dissociative, or avoidant type scenarios, mm-hmm. the ABCD baby type thing, people can look that up if they like. We can provide a link. You see a mismatch in the neurochemistry and the activation of these brain areas. In other words, the brain circuitry for attachment is set up so that, anxious states are evoked when calm states should have been. Have there been better parenting?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yes.
But then you take those, you essentially run the same sorts of studies on romantically attached young adults or older adults. And what you see is it's the same sets of neurons, the same circuits. I mean, this is remarkable. Nowhere else. To my awareness, nowhere else in the nervous system do we repurpose neural circuitry from early in life. You know, it's as if there's a neural circuit for sensing thirst and drinking early in life, and then later it's used for sensing how to navigate a city. Okay, now those are two very disparate things.
Yeah.
But this is like outrageous, right? And so I say it's either a feature or a bug, we don't know, but it is the way it is, right? I always say I wasn't consulted the design phase.
What do you think was the evolutionary logic of that?
I like to think in a kind of romantic way that some of our most important work in our lifetime is to try and resolve these developmental miswirings that are the consequence of faulty caretaker-infant relationship. And you can't blame the infant. Now, does that mean we blame our parents to the point of ostracizing them? Well, one would hope not. Maybe in some cases that's necessary. But I like to think that what we've observed over the last 10, 20, 30 years, in no small part, seriously, thanks to your work, reflects an evolution of how we are thinking about attachment, that we are actually getting better at understanding the self. And there's something about the human brain that wants to understand itself.
Very interesting.
So I like to think that in 100 years, not only will there be more models of relationship as functional, healthy relationships, but there will also be a deeper understanding of what this whole thing of love and attachment really is. And the parallel I use is one of biology. We understand so much more about brain function now than we did just 10 years ago. Addiction, for instance, not just a condition of failure of willpower, but this understanding about dopamine, and other molecules. I think we now look at a fentanyl addict or a heroin addict very differently. They're caught in a neurochemical algorithm that is not serving them well. It doesn't remove their responsibility, but there comes a point where they can't recover themselves and they need certain supports, and those supports are starting to emerge now. So my hope is that this is built into our evolution as some sort of vector toward progress.
It's interesting because some models of couples work, of couples therapy, will say you have recreated with each other patterns of your early life in order to be able to transcend them.
Right. The repetition compulsion. You get the same thing over and over again. Lord knows I've had that and some wonderful partners. And by the way, as I say that, I'm also taking 50% of the responsibility. So it's all, or 100% of the responsibility for the choice. As they say, you didn't have six hard relationships. You had one hard relationship six times, right? And I think Paul Conti says it that way. But that the repetition compulsion is a unconscious attempt to resolve the core conflict that arose during early attachment.
Correct.
Do you subscribe to that view?
I think it's a very useful idea. I was thinking at one point, it's like sometimes when I listen to you, and you know, there is an exactness in the things that you describe, often rooted in science and research, etc. Couples therapy or psychotherapy, relationship thinking, it's, you don't have an exact answer. First of all, you don't have an exact answer because modern relationships are more complex than ever. And I don't think any relationship expert at this point can have answers. You have invitations. You have ways of thinking that are useful. And here is the question. Is it true for me is answered by, do the people, does it resonate for them? If they buy it, then it's true. It's a framework. I can analyze this tableau in multiple ways. If this is the one that resonates for you, this is what we're going to go with. And that's what makes it true. This is a very interesting thing. There's multiple, I mean, to me, it's interesting because there's a whole movement within the world of psychotherapy and psychology that wants to actually become much more normatized with protocols and the same thing for everyone. I think that much of what, at least relationship therapy, which is really the world in the, that I practice in, is existential and it's meaning making. And there's a lot of ways to do that. So if this interpretation works for you, be my guest. But that's not because it is more true than another. It's the one that was useful for you. And that makes you much more humble.
I love that answer.
It's a little bit like when you raise kids, you know, mm-hmm. You think that I used to think that all these things I had done with my first one, you know, is because I had such good ideas. Then I had a second one and none of these things worked with them because it was a different person. You know, so I realized that the first one, it worked because there was a fit between my method and the person. And this is the important thing in therapy is that it's an issue of that fit is what you're looking for.
We hear a lot these days about the different attachment styles or languages of love, you know, the love languages, you know, people will say, I emphasize, you know, gifts feel very rewarding or acts of, words of affirmation, unstructured time or et cetera, or people will, I think nowadays, if they look into it a little bit, they'll, realize that they are either, you know, more avoidant or more anxious. These things can shift. I mean, I think it's wonderful that people are thinking about these things in the same way that I think it's wonderful that people understand that there's a molecule called dopamine that can do certain things, serotonin, certain things. But I'm curious as to whether or not you feel that the naming of things and the assignment of oneself to a category can sometimes be limiting in terms of one's ability to really embrace this curiosity. And you also use the word invitation, and you are describing couples therapy and healthy relationship as a bit more of an art form than a reductionist protocol oriented science, which I love because to me, you know, despite being a scientist, some of the great mystery of life and certainly of romantic relationship is, when you find yourself in happy places that you didn't anticipate finding yourself, or in a place of forgiveness and close friendship, when at one point you can recall being, like you said, like you just, this person is like embodies the worst things in your mind. So I think, I wonder if the processes that you found useful in your clinical work, is it possible to formalize those in a way that people can start to adopt them? In other words, do you think that we can learn to navigate relationship in more healthy ways, not just by saying I'm anxiously attached or avoidant or securely attached, I'm looking for someone that has that, or my love language is this and they love to do that, and so therefore we're a perfect lock and key? I think people are starting to think about relationship in a more nuanced and sophisticated way. And yet also what I'm hearing is it's a lot more dynamic than that. Mm-hmm. And that some of those categorizations that we assign ourselves can really perhaps be limiting to what could be.
It's a great question, but I have a moment now as if I'm in a session with you where I have like five things that are arriving here in front of my brain and I'm thinking, which one am I going to, I'm going to enter. I'm going to actually start with just the actual question, but then I probably is an opportunity to say a little bit about how I approach this thing. I think some naming is very useful. It frames it. It gives it a foundation, something to hold on to. Language matters. If we would not be having a conversation without having a shared language at this moment. But within that, you and I are using the same words and may have very different meanings attached to it. So that's the richness of the process is, what do you mean when you say invitation, curiosity, you know, conflict, etc.? For example, when I do the work on conflict, I did provide language. For example, one of the things that happens in conflict is we have confirmation bias. That's a cognitive framework that is often present in situations of emotional conflict, of conflict which involves always something, an emotional dimension, could be political too. Confirmation bias means that I am looking for evidence that reinforces my beliefs, and I disregard any evidence that contradicts it. Now, this happens between two people. This happens between two parties. That's a very important naming. You know, it's interesting. I've noticed this, but all you mentioned is that. Okay, cognitive bias. Another cognitive bias that is very common is fundamental attribution error. You know, we have this idea that I am complex and you are more simple. if I'm in a bad mood, it's because there was traffic. You know, there's circumstances, there's context. If you're in a bad mood, it's because you're a cantankerous person. That's just your personality. You know, we'll categorize and totalize the behavior of others, and we'll have lots of nuance and poetry for our own. That's a concept. That concept is very useful. It's neutral. It doesn't blame anybody. And it says, we all do this. I like that kind of naming. This is very different from the kind of naming that pathologizes people, the kind of naming that locks you into one identity. You know, you may have addiction, and addiction may be really important. It may have destroyed your life, but to just say you're an addict. I worked in an addiction center for 2 years, and, you know, people had there were a lot of other things happening in these people's lives. And to just focus on this one thing it reduces the person, but it also reduces your ability to do something with the person. It narrows your lens. So there's always this question about how wide is the lens that you not get overwhelmed. So you want to make it smaller, but not that small that you're looking through a keyhole. A person is more complex than a keyhole. You know, we don't just treat symptoms. We work with lives. That's the difference for me anyway, in the work that we do. And then when you begin to think about lives, then you start to think about culture. What is happening in the world of relationships today? It's such an incredible thing that is going on. And if you don't put that in the broader context, I'm trained as a systemically oriented family therapist, and that means that you're looking at the interaction of different systems. And I think that a lot of what happens is a hyper-individualization of these things. And the naming is useful when it expands your understanding. The naming is not useful when it locks you into a symptom, a reductionistic thing, that gives false certainty to prophets.
I can't agree more that naming that expands one's understanding and maybe even lends itself to a hint of curiosity,
yes,
stands a chance of having some rehabilitative quality to it. I feel that nowadays there's such an overuse of psychological terms, like narcissist,
yeah,
gaslighting, therapy terms. It's almost the way that if people were to talk about neurobiology as neurosurgeons, right? I'm not a neurosurgeon, but I have friends who are. And neurosurgery is like something people train for many, many, many years for, just as being a clinical psychologist, people train for many years for and have a ton of in-office experience, real world experience. Nowadays, the naming and the attachment of names to particular top contour features of people out there seems to be largely for the purpose of closing off possibility as opposed to increasing possibility. However,
it's both. Because on the one hand, more than many other forms of medicine or healthcare or care, psychotherapy, psychology, but certainly psychotherapy, was always stigmatized and still is in many parts of the world. It's for the crazies. It's for people. There must be something fundamentally wrong. I mean, it's something that nobody went around talking about the fact that they are in therapy. You went to see a therapist. You know, now you're putting it on your dating app. You know, it's a status symbol. So there is a destigmatizing that is very important. But there is also words that are weaponized and they are not useful and they are separating people. And we have enough separation at this moment in our societies in the West. We don't need more efforts to pull people apart. We need efforts to bring back the collective, the community, the shared experience, because we are too far apart. And that's why I think that some naming is useful and some naming is not always that useful.
Well, amen to bringing people together more. Such an important mission right now. I'd like to explore the possibility of something that I've heard, but I don't know if it's true, that sex, which of course doesn't just include intercourse, but the things that lead into and out of sexual intercourse, but that sex is a microcosm for the relationship at large, meaning that the dynamics that show up in intimate interactions are somehow reflective of a larger working out or dynamic in the relationship. To what extent do you think that's true? It's a concept that I've heard. It sounds interesting, and any discussion about sex tends to, you know, get people's ears pricked up because it's depending on where you live in the world, it's either something that people talk about casually, openly, or with a lot of, electricity around it. But I always like to say, you know, as a biologist, we can all agree on one thing, which is that we're all here because sperm met egg, if not in human, in dish, and then eventually in human. So we're still at that point in human right. evolution. Right. So, what are your views about intimacy and sex as a reflection of the relationship? And here, what I'm thinking of again are these, when you described conflict, you described these three different positioning of arrows towards one another, separate, away from one another, one chasing the other. Is there a parallel for healthy relationship that we can offer up?
Sexually?
Yeah. Before talking about this question of whether or not sex is a microcosm of the larger relationship, the health of the relationship.
Let me start like this. I mean, I've studied sexuality for quite a few decades now in relationships, but I think maybe because of what you said around the world, love and desire are universal experiences, but the way that they are constructed are highly culturally contextual. And so the most archaic, rooted, traditional aspects of a culture or a society are lodged around its beliefs and attitudes and behaviors towards sexuality and relationships, especially the sexuality of women. American elections, case in point. But the most radical, progressive changes that take place in a society also occur around sexuality and relationships. Sexuality of women in particular. So sexuality is a window into a society. Mm-hmm. Sexuality is also a window into a relationship and into a person that invites deep listening. One of the big challenges is that modern sexuality has been, I mean, traditional sexuality was identified with procreation. Modern sexuality is identified with performance and outcome. Sex is something you do. To which I say, let's drop the performance and outcome for a moment and let's think of it as an experience. So now you're going to start to see the choreography I draw. When I think of sexuality as an experience and I say sex isn't just something that you do, sex is a place you go. So my question to you is, where do you go in sex? Inside yourself and with another or others? Do you go to seek deep spiritual union? a deep intimate connection, transcendence? Do you go to a place for vulnerability, a place to surrender, a place to be taken care of, a place to be safely powerful, a place to be naughty, a place to have just plain fun, a place to abdicate your responsibilities of good citizenship because sexual desire is quite politically incorrect? Where do you go in sex? What parts of yourself do you try to connect with? What is it that you're expressing there? Sexuality is a coded language for our deepest emotional needs. Our wounds, our fears, our aspirations, our longings. It's that. That is, you know, sex is never just sex, even when it's hit and run. And then it becomes really interesting. So one of the things that, one of the assumptions that existed very much at the heart of my field and that I challenged or questioned was that sexual problems are by definition the consequence of relationship problems. So you fix the relationship and the sex will follow. And I, together with many colleagues, have helped a lot of relationships get along better, fight less, laugh more, enjoy each other, and it changed nothing in the bedroom. Because, in fact, maybe sexuality is not a metaphor of the relationship. Maybe sexuality is a parallel narrative to the relationship. And that, in fact, when you change the sexuality in a couple, you change the whole relationship. But not necessarily in the other direction. So that opened up a whole, that was one of the foundational ideas for Mating in Captivity, my first book, because I have been trained to think like this. And then I began to think love and desire, they relate, but they also conflict. They're not one and the same, and they don't need the same things. They don't thrive on the same elements. And modern relationships, romantic relationships, have wanted to reconcile those two fundamental sets of human needs into one relationship. That is the grand experiment of modern love.
And am I correct in interpreting what you just said as that love and desire are fundamentally separate, that they can exist in parallel, but that any goal of society, much less a couple, to try and unify those as one thing is not going to succeed?
No, not at all. It actually has been remarkably successful. The romantic ideal is tenacious. Mm-hmm. You know, many other philosophies and ideologies of the end of the 19th century have all gone. This one has survived many others.
I'm relieved to hear you say that.
The romantic.
Maybe I grew up on too many. I don't know how many romantic comedies I saw, but I grew up in a home where love, sex, and romance were discussed in very almost ethereal terms.
Yeah. No. I think that but it is an experiment. It's not something that we have tried throughout history, in human history. So I think that if you ask, it's an exercise I like to do sometimes. I say, divide your page with a line in the middle, up from top to bottom. And on the top left, you write, when I think of love, I think of. Then go to the other side, and when I think of sexuality, I think of. And then you go back and you say, and when I am loved, I feel. And when I am desired, I feel. When I'm wanted. And when I love, I feel. And when I want or I desire, I feel. And when I think about the love between me and my partner, if there is a couple, and when I think about the sexuality between me and my partner, and then you let people free associate about this. And there are words that you find back and forth, and then there are words who just never appear in the other column.
Do you recommend that couples exchange these documents?
Yeah, they do it at the same time. Then they read it out loud in front of each other. I do it in groups, you know, huge audiences as well. But what I'm asking people to see is when you look at what you responded in both categories, create a line between those two. Is it a thick line, like what happens in love is completely separate from me than what happens in desire? I need a complete different set of things. I express myself differently. I interact differently. Or is it very much that when this exists, it completely ignites that? They are interrelated, interdependent. One feeds on each other. One reinforces the other. There is a degree of variety about that. For some people, love and desire are inseparable. And for some people, they are often irretrievably disconnected. And I think the model wants them to be really together. And for a lot of people, it's exactly what they aspire to. For other people, it's more challenging.
Because somehow in them, there's a split between these two
things. Because some people experience love in such a way that it sometimes becomes challenging for them to make love to the person they love. What I mean by that is that love comes with a sense of responsibility, worry, care about the well-being of the other person. And some of us sometimes have learned to love in a way that comes with extra worry, extra responsibility, extra burden. We were the parents of our parents. We took care of our depressed parent. We took care of our alcoholic parent. We learned to love with a sense that is not free, that is not curious or playful, because curiosity cannot happen in a state of stress, as you so well said. When we experience love with that extra sense of burden, it is difficult to be with someone that you feel close to and at the same time go inside yourself and completely chill and relax in pleasure land. That's one of the scenarios. There's many others, but this is one of the more common ones, Michael Bader's work, that makes it difficult for some people to experience love and desire at the same time. The more they love, the more challenging the desire becomes for them, because desire is to own the wanting. You can't make someone want. You can make someone have sex, but you can never make them want. Want is your sovereignty, your autonomy, your freedom. And for some people, that wanting cannot exist when they are with someone that they feel so responsible and worried and anxious about. And that's the attachment piece that you're talking about. So this is how attachment style often manifests in the way that you then organize your sexual self.
What percentage of infidelity do you think reflects somebody's inability to integrate this love component from desire component, such that they find that they only experience desire or strong desire outside their committed relationship?
Look, I wrote an entire book about infidelity, as in what happens when desire goes looking elsewhere. I think that some people go outside as a response to a lot of discontents in the relationship, loneliness being the first one, neglect, indifference, conflict, rejection, sexual rejection in particular. But some people go outside, and it has very little to do with the relationship. It sometimes has to do with how they organize themselves in the relationship, to the degree that in order to feel a certain freedom or ability to think about themselves, they need to be outside. And I used to say, I have seen a lot of infidelity in happy relationships. It's not always a symptom of a flawed relationship, by no means. And that in those situations, people tell me, it's not that I wanted to find another person. It's that I wanted to find another self or to reconnect with lost parts of myself. And I don't say this to promote or to condone or anything, but I just listened across the globe. One word, it's not that I wanted to find another partner, it's that I wanted to find something else inside of me. And I don't know how to do that in the relationship that I'm in. And that's not because of the person I'm with. That's because of what I do to myself in the context of intimate connection. And the word that you hear all over the globe, when you interview people who are in affairs, is that they feel alive. It's kind of the erotic as an antidote to deadness. They feel that aliveness. And that doesn't mean this. They often, that doesn't necessarily involve sex. It's about something. Aliveness is that the erotic, not the sexual. And the erotic is the quality of aliveness, vibrancy, vitality, hopefulness, curiosity, imagination, playfulness. It's those elements that often people lose for a host of reasons. Life, work, children, dying parents, illness, economic hardship, you name it, you know. And there's a sense that they need to go elsewhere to find that. And some people would say bullshit justification, and some people understand that at the heart of affairs, there is betrayal and long and duplicity and lying and all of that. But there is also longing and loss on an existential level. That's a very different lens into this. So the people for whom that reconciliation that you talk about is more challenging are often people who are often more likely to compartmentalize.
What you just said brings me back to this idea that we were exploring at the very beginning of this conversation, that it seems that so much of navigating relationship in healthy versus unhealthy ways depends on this internal dynamic within ourselves of an ability to be in close, intimate relationship with another and yet hold on to enough of our own identity,
right,
and evolve that identity within the relationship to the other.
That is the definition of intimacy, or a definition of intimacy. And that is probably the number one task of every relationship, a romantic relationship, is how do I get close to you without losing me? And how do I hold on to me without losing you? Now, you know, I said to you in the beginning that we grow up and we have both needs, togetherness and separateness. And then we come out of our childhoods, and some of us need more space, freedom, separateness. And some of us need more protection, connection, togetherness. Of course, we tend to meet somebody whose proclivities match our vulnerabilities. And so you find that in many relationships, you have one person who is more afraid of losing the other, and one person who is more afraid of losing themselves. One person more afraid with the fear of abandonment, and one person more afraid with the fear of suffocation.
This is a recurring dynamic that, yes, you see. And does it swap back and forth across couples, male, female? I'm assuming in that example, heterosexual relationship.
No, all
but even homosexual relationships, you'll see it switch back and forth, or it tends to be a pretty stable feature, meaning one person in the couple tends to be afraid of abandonment, the other person, abandonment by the other person more deeply afraid of abandonment of themselves.
Right. It doesn't switch back and forth. It switches by relationship, but not within one relationship. You may have been at different, in different roles with different partners.
Indeed, I have. So interesting. Again, not because you weren't clear. You were incredibly clear and concise about this, but I think this is such an important concept. Maybe you'd repeat it for us again, just so that people can really drive it into their consciousness and maybe ask themselves the question, are they more afraid of abandonment by the other or abandonment of themselves?
You know, one of the ways that you sometimes can see this is that, I mean, in the tour this week, one woman stood up and basically said, I recently divorced. I would like to be able to enter another relationship again. And I said, is the issue an issue of trust? Or is the issue, was there betrayal? Was it, what's led? She says, how do I allow somebody to enter into my life without losing myself? Mm. So it's in the language, you know. It's one person, but this could, and really, I think it's very important for me. Many of these things are not gender specific nor orientation particular. This is human. But then I answered a little bit with some of this and other things. And so then the next question is, how often do you not say what you really think? Because you want to please, or you want to harmonize, or you want to avoid conflict. How often did you then resent the partner who actually stood for their ground? Because if you're afraid to lose yourself, you're often more the one who stands for your ground. You don't give in because and if it's rigid, you don't give in at all because you think that every time even the language agreeing is giving in, and giving in is a losing a part of myself. I mean,
Kita kukukan wa te kawar kasing ka no yang ano kasing kawaka inkhata tamaka Ministry of Agriculture, Fisheries, Water and Land Reform. Iko kukukan wa ngangin mongse ohwagrenu haka inkhaung jisiti geto ma I okoka inkhosin. Kani amaku okon amaka wa ano ka akataha. Asukure dan ano ka wa kumibya ano akaka. Kepun angkatatin amaku kan kecewar kaha. Sisa tanjakan amaku onu amatawan anuk wasisa kegia katosis muha. Komunal Land Reform Act 5 of 2003 kukokhaika acisen doha. Sisa tekugia kukhamaka wakan anuk agatosis muha. Aco waka kawaka wa kawaka mariga ho aco kumunaka tirinkwe. Amaku okok amaka wa anuk a Kutut ang gaga chosa ka kamus kapi. So ang ha yaga anuk a wamar ka amga tem ang ka na kuita siya sin sin kutwa kamaha. Unja ka anuk a kutu ang gaga kapi ka wang ha anuk a kaga ako ka unka chisa tigya ka ato ha. At ang kla ka ati sin ka chiso sin bati ko kaya ka o ka nung amapun amaku ka wang a kaga o kla ka ka traditional authority Communal Land Board and Ministry can do the same to make a quality gaha. Mukosison kaya 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 muka chasins aka damise tijo kuteha. Ministry kaya kiko kusunja ka kuara kaya ka chasin se toko muka maka kwa kateha. Anuka ako kumu teka kereka teko kumu oko kukuge. Na we juwar kasin se toko sison kaya kaya ka radio mumu kaya toko muka maka we Kajaga government wa Namibia ama Kwaka Republic kawa Germany ka Kamaka Germany Development Tenka Jaka Ngaikosin Akan ama kwika Ministry Kanduarsin seko tu ama Buka Public Relation Kanduarsin Kanu kamaka Ministry of Agriculture Fisheries Water and Land Reform Jaka telefono makawa 06-10-20-0-6-0-3
Built in. It's so, it starts here and it continues all the way. It's like, so, you know what I mean? It's a sequence of things. You break apart in small granular pieces. How does it play out for you when you lose yourself? What are the things you do not do that facilitate this dissolution? And to the other person, who is, when you're afraid, sorry, of losing the other. And when you're afraid of losing yourself, like, where's your rigidity? Where is your kind of totalistic thinking? Where is this lack of flexibility? And that may manifest in, I don't travel to those places. The sentence that indicates that we're dealing with this bigger issue is something sometimes very anodyne, you know. I don't go to those kind of restaurants. You know, why shall I go to those kind of places? And you kind of want to say, why is there such intensity about a restaurant? What are you fighting against? And what are you fighting for? And why are you even fighting? We're talking about going out, supposed to be fun. Now you start rewinding. You know, what is this statement connected to that we are going to have, so now you have conflict meeting, identity meeting, connection to another person. This is when and it is sleuth work. It's fantastically engaging and exciting. It's like, I'm sure when you do scientific research, it's that sleuth work that you say, this thing doesn't fit at all. You know, why do you want me to wear blue shoes? Why do you make such a big deal out of the blue shoes? What are blue shoes for you? Don't start talking about the shoes, please. Talk about you know, boundaries. But boundaries today is a concept that has become so ill-used almost. So it's talk about how the preservation of the self now involves not wearing blue shoes. I mean, you get what I'm...
I do, and I my mind keeps flitting back to this parallel construction of these circuits were built in infancy and childhood and adolescence. And I'm what kind of flashed to mind is when we are adolescents and teenagers, there's this fundamental question that we ask that rarely do we ask again later in life. I mean, maybe people do, but the question is kind of, who am I? You know, teenagers try on a lot of different identities often, and how they dress, you know, is one of the ways in which they self-identify. Their music, I mean, the music we listen to when we're teenagers and young adults is forever stamped into us as like some core part of our identity. It has an emotional weight that music that we arrive to later doesn't, unless it resonates with that early music or recapitulates that rather. So in my mind, I'm thinking, I wonder if these circuits that are struggling with holding on to self versus a kind of playful, curious exploration of new things, mm-hmm. novelty, which is so fundamental to relationship. And they're not, they're as we say as neurobiologists, are really antagonistic, that they're really in a push-pull. I mean, there's so many things that we're discussing today that really feel as if these are like circuits that can't be coactive easily, that they're like, that we're in this internal grappling match. And what keeps coming to mind...
But they also need each other.
Right. They're, I mean, they're like the, right. It's like the front axle and the back axle of a vehicle. Like you know, can't exist without both.
You just made me think of something because you asked before that the thing about the sexuality and I like the concept of erotic blueprints, which I work with a lot. And I try to really kind of distill it in this Desire Bundle course that I'm releasing, that it, because I thought, how can people ask themselves a set of questions? Like a lot of my work is about finding the good questions that will, mm-hmm. you know, a good question is like a portal, right? And the line on top, which is the answer to your question, is tell me how you were loved and I will tell you how you make love. Not just how you love, but how you make love, meaning that your emotional history is inscribed in the physicality of sex. And it's all about what you asked me in the beginning, identity and change, holding on to oneself, connecting with the other. Sexuality is the place where this occurs at the most fundamental level. It's to be inside oneself and inside the other at the same time, their universe, not their orifices. That is what is the experience, that temporary oneness that then again opens up as two people. So people who struggle with that emotionally, how do I stay connected to me and then to you without these polarities, experience that in sex. And then you ask a set of questions. How did you learn to love and with whom? Were you protected by those people who took care of you, or did you have to flee for protection? Did they take care of you or did you take care of them? Did they hold you, rock you, cuddle you, or did they harm you or violate you or shake you? Was it okay to laugh and to cry? Was it okay to experience pleasure? Was it safe? You know, a set of questions like that. And this is where people enter their erotic blueprint and get to see that their emotional challenges are directly, if you film them, if you watch them making love, you'll understand their emotional challenges. But then comes the next level. And if you then study their fantasy lives, then you'll understand the depth of their emotional needs, which are brought into their sexuality.
Fascinating.
You get it?
I get it. I get it. And it, makes me think that this earlier discussion we were having, you know, is sex a microcosm for the larger relationship? It sounds to me like the answer is yes, but especially the relationship to self.
Yes.
And especially there's a lot of information in one's desire template or blueprint about how one was cared for or not cared for.
your sexual preferences, your sexual fantasies are a translation of your deepest emotional needs. Not sexual needs, emotional needs. Mm-hmm. You know, my mother used to say, tell me about your friends and I'll tell you who you are. And then I said, you tell me about you sexually and I will know a heck of a lot about who you are. But you have to translate. The problem of sexuality in modern society is the literalness with which we approach it. And in our pornographic society, ever more so, to our detriment.
Right. I couldn't agree more. And I think that there also seems to be this attempt to directly translate from, well, if somebody had issues with their mother, then they're going to have issues with women as an adult. Or if they had issues with their father, they're going to have issues with men as an adult.
That's confirmation bias.
Right. But in reality, it's the algorithm. It's that these algorithms that are laid down in our neural circuitry earlier, they don't care about male-femaleness. I mean, it doesn't change whether or not people are heterosexual or homosexual. That's innate to them, I believe. I think these are, frankly, biologically driven. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that our ways of being don't translate directly that way, that these are deeper processes. So if one had issues, for instance, with their, who's male and heterosexual, but they had issues with their father, they could have the same issues with women as an adult, right? That it could translate, that it's not always mapping male to male, female to female.
I have a segment of my podcast, Where Should We Begin, that opens the tour, where basically they talk about how they met, and then they fight about everything all the time. And they think that they're fighting. This is the line of the show. They think they're fighting about the closet, the cat litter, and the cat. What I think they're fighting about is that when she says, why didn't you close the closet? He instantly thinks of his dad, who was this military guy who told him, you know, and he is basically in a fight saying to her, you ain't telling me what to do. You ain't the boss of me. So she can never make a request for which he doesn't feel like she's controlling him. And he answers with this fight. And that throws her into the, she grew up all alone, you know, took care of her two siblings, mother was gone, et cetera, et cetera. And she hoped her whole life she would finally meet a partner and she wouldn't feel alone and there would be somebody to support her. And every time he says to her, you ain't the boss of me, don't tell me what to do, she says, oh, I'm going to be alone for the rest of my life. Here I am in the worst place that I always wanted to avoid. This is what they're fighting about. But they're talking about, why did you leave the cat closet open?
Beautiful example. Beautiful example. It cuts across our preconceived notions that if somebody had a good relationship with their mother, they will have a good relationship with women. If they had a good relationship with father, well, with
it's
men.
It's a little bit more subtle and complicated, nuanced than that. I think the frameworks are useful, but they are frameworks. And they're models that help us to think and make sense of things. But it's a little bit like in science, you know, the truth of today is the joke of tomorrow.
I hadn't heard that, but that one's going up on X. Repair work is something that is so fundamental to healthy relationships.
It connects to what we discussed about apology.
What is your recommendation for how couples think about repair work? Let's assume that they're still together and there's some at least hint of a hope to recover the relationship. Should repair work be framed as in a particular way to facilitate it? You know, how does one begin? I mean, I can sort of we've been doing a lot of threes today, so I can imagine mistakes, misunderstandings, and betrayals. Right. There are mistakes like I accidentally step on somebody's toes. There's misunderstandings. Two people thought the same thing. And then there are outright betrayals. And my understanding from your work is that you've seen many couples, indeed helped many couples, recover from all three of those categories to the point where they are quite satisfied with their relationship.
There's a sequence to this. And it's true in intimate relationships. It's true in friendships. I'm very interested in friendships these days and in friendship therapy, in I do co-founders work. I mean, there's other dyads that I'm very interested in beyond the romantic unit. But you said something before that I thought actually I may come back to when you said, you know, it's about acknowledging that you were wrong. sometimes you may not have been wrong, but you were hurtful. Mm-hmm. And rather than get all, you know, I didn't do anything, it doesn't matter. What you did, even if you don't think it was anything terrible, seemed to have really upset your partner. Do you care about that? Or you want to just kind of stand? So I think the first piece in repair work, and I think, by the way, that repair is not the end of the story. The revival is the end of the story.
Much better word.
The erotic recovery. Erotic in my sense of the, in my definition of the word. So that's when I say it's not enough to survive. I'm a child of survivors. I wanted to see people who, how do they continue to live? Not just how do they stay alive? And I think that's a fundamental difference in our lives and in our relationships. It's a huge piece of, it's really at the heart of my work and of my life, you know? So every trauma process, of nations or of individuals, demands the acknowledgement of what happened. And that acknowledgement involves remorse and guilt for the hurt and the harm that it caused, even if you don't feel guilty for the act itself and you think the act is justified. The consequences of the act on the other person is where the guilt and the remorse must take place. Without that, there is very little option for repair. If I don't feel that you even know what you did to me, my dad, you my boss, you my political enemy, I mean, that it's really at the root. So after you do the remorse and the guilt, the next part is to be really careful that you don't sink into the self. Now I'm going back to relationships, into the shame. I'm such a terrible person. How could I do something like this? So I feel so bad about myself that I still can't feel bad about you. Now that's narcissism. That's a different story. The point is not for you to still think that you're at the center. You were at the center when you hurt, and now you're at the center of your own wound. It's really a process of reckoning with the other person. And it's slow and challenging for some, and it's immediate for others. And then I think the next piece in a relationship is not just to apologize and to show your remorse, but it's actually to show that you value the other person. Because hurting a person, and especially when it's betrayal and careless, is a devaluation of the other person. You didn't matter. That me mattered more than you. For whatever the reasons, it was still selfish, and I devalued you. And to become the vigilante of a relationship is that you become the person who protects the relationship by showing that the other person really matters. And in detail, that sometimes means, you know, how are you today? Is there anything you want to talk about? Do you still think about it? You know, this is a big one to carry every day. Are you able to go to see this movie? Can we, you know, just without being so afraid that every time you ask, you're going to get blamed again, or you're going to feel so bad about yourself. It's a little bit step out of yourself and just reach out and just check in. Half the time when you say, how are you? And you want to talk, the person says, no, I don't. But I just wanted to know that you are prepared to, in case I needed to. Set the conditions. Make me feel that you value me and our relationship, which you have just trashed. And then the third thing is what I call the erotic recovery. It's the regeneration or the generation of new cells. I need a new skin to come over the scab. That's the real, you know, repair is not yet healing. The healing is, I know I hurt myself somewhere. It's here. I can feel it when I touch it, but I don't feel it the whole time. It's not front and center every moment of my obsessive rumination. But when I touch it, it's tender. It's wounded. It's a place that I need to make sure not to hit again. And don't hurt me again. And don't do this to me again. I can't recover from that twice. It's very It's that vulnerable. And then it says, let's go do new things. You know, erratic recovery is not about comfortable and familiar and a return to the status quo. Erratic recovery is about new, risky, curious, playful, unknown imagination outside of the comfort zone so that we can see ourselves anew as who we are and how and who we are together. And I think that's where the revival takes place. It's hopeful, it's possibility, it's adventure, it's got that energy.
Beautiful, aspirational, and realistic too. This notion of, not notion, forgive me, this act of truly getting outside of oneself to be present to the way the other person feels, irrespective of who was right or who was wrong, if it was misunderstanding, betrayal, but especially in cases of betrayal. The exiting of, as you said, either a stance of not wanting to look at it for oneself or of self-flagellation. Both are self-centered.
Yeah.
So really getting into real genuine care for, if not caretaking, or the offer of care for the other person.
I can't believe I hurt you that bad. You know, one of the big things is people are often shocked at the hurt of the, I thought you wouldn't care about what I thought I, or I didn't think about it. I just didn't, because there is a dissociation that takes place when you take off. And so the, when people are faced with the raw hurt, wound, suffering, collapse, fracture of the other person, they find it very hard to tolerate. And this has to happen. You have to be able to know the consequences of your action. If you want to, you know, freedom in the existentialist Sartrean terms involved the ability to take responsibility for the consequence of your actions. This is it. I'll help you face that. That doesn't mean that you become the worst creature on the planet, but you are, you have to face that. And that is something very hard for us because sometimes we meant it. Sometimes we thought we deserve it. And sometimes we didn't think that that was going to be the case. And so it's sometimes easier to stand in front of someone else's anger than someone else's hurt.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you're describing also perhaps at least partially explains why sometimes, not always, apologies are insufficient, necessary, but not sufficient, because there are certain modes of apology that don't show us that the person is who's apologizing is really outside themselves. They're in their own guilt. They're in their own shame. And therefore, they're not really present to how we feel.
No. There's a beautiful book by Harriet Lerner about apology that I often recommend in these situations because she really analyzes. If you ever do apology, you know, she this concept of sincerity, of the apology that actually shows that I care about you and not just about restoring my dignity and my pride and all of that. You know, the maneuvers that are about self-preservation versus the maneuvers that are really about restorative justice.
Who is ready for relationship? And for people who are not in relationship or who are, what sorts of questions should they be asking themselves? What sorts of things should we all be doing?
You know, what's a question that I ask people often, almost in the first session? Knowing yourself as well as you do, what do you think makes it hard to live with you?
Great question. My answer is far too long to give here. Everyone will be relieved.
That will give you some of the material about, you know, who nobody's ready, as in I'm prepared, I'm perfect, I'm fully baked. I say to every person, everyone has relationship issues they're going to have to address at some point in their life. The only question is with whom? Not if, just with whom? Who's the one that you're going to do the work with? We're all works in progress. We are notoriously imperfect, rather unpredictable. And many relationship problems are not problems that you solve. They're paradoxes that you have to learn to manage.
Well, I want to make clear that before what I say next, that if I had my way, we would continue this conversation for many hours, if not days. Perhaps there's an opportunity for that in the future. But I was told, and not surprisingly, that you're in tremendous demand. You're on a live tour now. I can't wait to see this. It's all sold out, so I'll have to wait like everyone else. But sounds like it an incredible experience. Indeed, I know some people and have spoken directly to them who attended one of your lives recently, and they sound like a completely immersive and experience like no other. So I'm very excited about that. My only regret about your tour is that we have to halt this conversation in the next couple of minutes. And there are a couple of things I just want to reflect back to you that are all from a place of real deep appreciation. First of all, for bringing forward what you've brought today, you're one of these exceedingly rare people with whom, when they speak, like gems just fall out of them. And I know I'm not alone in this sentiment. I mean, just in today's conversation, you've transformed the way that I think about relationship, self, identity, neurobiology, love, sex, so many key topics. And in a much larger way, as you pointed out, and I completely agree, the themes that you're talking about are not just fundamental for us to resolve as individuals. They are not just fundamental for us to resolve in couples or whatever relationship configuration people happen to be in.
They're societal.
That we can look at anything, an election, two countries battling one another, political groups, whatever. At every level, this is what it means to be human, built up from the same fundamental circuit, same fundamental dynamics. And I really see you as not just a pioneer, but the pioneer of this parting of the veil from what has, I think, until this point in human history, been a lot of descriptions of things of what's right, what's wrong, this and that. And some of that might be true. I don't know. I'm not qualified to know. But that you represent a real parting of the veil into the next evolution of what it means for humans to interact in more healthy ways and with curiosity and sense of invitation toward more love, connection, and peace. So, there really aren't words to express how enthusiastic and appreciative I am of what you brought here today and what you're doing. And so I just want to say, deep heartfelt thanks. And thank I know you. I speak for many, many people.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Thank you for joining me for today's discussion about romantic relationships with Esther Perel. To find links to Esther's new course on
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any
Want to know
staff.
About Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than The Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
So, where should we begin? Modern dating. First of all, the verb dating, to be a dater. I mean, these are all very new concepts. This period that is often quite protracted in which people are meeting one person after another, secluded from their entire life, very isolated from their life in this space called virtuality. So I wanted to explore modern dating, and I brought a number of different daters, each of them with their delights and their complaints about the experience of dating, each of them in very different stages of life, and in very different kinds of aspirations and disappointments about romantic love and especially about romantic consumerism. I'm Esther Perel. Join me for the next episode of Where Should We Begin? Dating is a phase in the life of relationships and in the life of people that is crucial. How do we date? Where do we date? What are the protocols, the rituals of dating in different cultures? Who gets to say what they want? Who gets to be chosen? Who gets to choose? How do we swipe? It's like a portal when you say the word dating, and some of you are currently dating, and some of you are just so fatigued that you want to go cold turkey. And others are wondering, maybe I should go back and start dating again. And some of you are in a relationship wondering, what would it be like? What's it like out there if I was to leave? So dating puts us directly in touch with a host of questions about our relationships, what we seek there, how we see ourselves, how we connect to each other. And I am here on a blind date with three people who are currently dating, each with a completely different story, each at a different stage of their life. Some looking for partnership and lifelong relationships, hopefully, and some looking to have good time. Some enjoy it, some dread it, and everything in between. And part of app dating, digital dating, allows us to meet an enormous amount of people that we would never have had a chance to meet. And at the same time, the excess choice, the enormous amount of possibilities, the paradox of choice, the inability to just see one person emerge from this whole lot of people brings fatigue, brings numbness, and brings a certain kind of desocializing, you know, where we begin to treat each other in ways that are very unkind, make us feel not really respected, esteemed, treated as a human being. And sometimes we are on the receiving end of this, and sometimes we are on the doing end of this, as you can hear from some of the people in the conversation. So let's talk about dating. Hi, hi.
Hello.
Hi, everyone.
Hello. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, yes. You haven't had a chance to meet, right?
No,
not yet. Afraid not. No.
So we're all on a blind date.
Yes, ma'am.
Can you just introduce yourselves, where you're from, how old you are, if you've had long-term relationships, but just to have a sense of what have been your experiences with relationships as a whole, rather than just our focus today on dating.
Should I go first?
Yeah, go ahead.
So my name is Louis. I'm in my late 20s. I work in accounting. And when it comes to dating, I was originally born in Africa, in Cameroon. I moved to the US when I was in my early 20s. And that's when I first came out as gay, obviously, and started dating. I have been in one long relationship about a year and a half. I have had several dates that last for about 3 to 6 months on average. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty much my experience so far.
I'm Allie. I live just outside of Boston. I'm 47 years old. I grew up in Saudi Arabia, and I moved to the US when I was 15. And I met my now very much ex-husband when I was 23. We were together for a long time. We were married for about 10 years before that came to sort of a screeching halt. And I've been divorced for maybe 5 years now-ish, and I've had one longer-term relationship in that time.
Yes, Douglas.
Yes, hello. My name is actually not Douglas. It's a very difficult Korean name that most people can't say, and Douglas is my alias. I'm from Korea, obviously. I moved a bit more than a year ago to Los Angeles because I got a job out here. And since then, I have been looking for a long-term partner, a romantic relationship, because before then, I'd always known that I was going to move away at some point. So I didn't really pursue that actively. And since getting here, I've been really at it. Since then, I have met one person who I went out with for a few months before she broke it off. It's been interesting. I've learned a lot.
Do you meet people in person? How do you go about it? This is a verb suddenly, you know, dating.
Yes.
And it, by the way, does the word exist in Korean?
No, that's a good point, Esther.
Right. Does the word exist in French? Louis?
Yes, I would say. Rendezvous, sortir.
Yeah, but that's not a verb.
That's not a verb.
And does the word, the verb exist in Arabic?
Not as a verb.
Right.
No.
Because there is something, of course, everybody now does it in the same way, but as a verb, it doesn't translate in many other languages. There is no such a thing as dating.
you meet people, you go out, you mm-hmm. see someone, you've met someone, you're interested in someone, but you're not on a mission. Dating is an active verb that seeks an outcome. So, I mean, there's a lot of things to say about how this has become an activity rather than a rendezvous, rather than an encounter. So if I asked you one thing about your last date that stood out for you, or datings, doesn't have to be one, but what has kind of carried you or stayed with you in your recent dating?
I've noticed that it's very difficult to stay in touch with someone, even if they're very nice and potentially very compatible with me. If there's no some kind of attraction in the earlier stages, and I've been finding it difficult to feel attracted to a lot of people on my dates. Yeah, so I'm noticing that about myself and seeing what I can do about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Louis?
Okay. So for my most recent date, so to me, it's dating is a bit of a pattern, if you ask me. And I also had experience to ask most of my friends. So it always goes from the really, really high, like high emotions, high attractions, and then it just fades out or drops suddenly. So that's kind of how it usually goes most of the time. And something that stands out for me on most of the dates I go to, it's not necessarily connection, but it's the interaction that I have with the person. It's the way they present themselves. It's the way they make me want to present myself, and they make me want to interact with them. So I feel like every single time it's always different. So it's always different, but at the same time, it has like kind of like a vibration, kind of a way of going every single time, if it makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Douglas says, I struggle to get to feel any attraction on many of the dates I go to. And you say, I actually have splurges of attraction, but it fizzles out very quickly.
Yes.
Yeah. And what's something that you would like to focus on today, or a question that you bring to our conversation?
One thing I was expecting to get out of today's conversation, it's actually get a better understanding of where other people are standing. That's first, like where other people are and in the dating phase. So hopefully they are those previous partners that I have had before, you know, kind of understand what is the angle, how they're looking at things. And maybe that could help me kind of adjust and kind of direct or be more understandable, or be more patient, or being more relaxed when it comes to it, not just put everything all at first, you know, all the attraction, kind of tone it down a little bit or spread it out for the mm-hmm. long run.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And for today, what would be something that's important for you?
I think something that I'm finding is I'm very ambivalent about dating. And I think a little bit more like you, Douglas, like I don't find myself getting super excited to go on dates. And I find the process kind of tedious.
Mm-hmm.
So I think my friends are kind of sick of me talking to them about this all the time. Most of them are partnered. So I think that I don't have a lot of other, you know, folks who are actively dating in my life right now. So anything that can get me like a little bit out of that ambivalence, I think, is what I'm looking for.
How do you meet, Douglas? You're primarily on the apps. Which one? Where do you meet your people? Where do you meet your dates?
I have met the majority of them, of course, on the dating apps, I would say.
Which one?
I'm on Hinge. That's the only one that I'm on. And otherwise, I am very active. I go out a lot. I try to be social.
How about you, Louis?
Me, when it comes to dating, I meet people organically out, usually. I'm very extroverted. I tend to go out on parties, out and drinking, and also on the app a lot. So on the app, I've used all of them. Tinder, Bumble, Hinge, and a special one, Grindr, mm-hmm. for the kids. And yes, so that's usually how I meet them. And I tend to be more of a meeting in person type of person. I don't really do a long conversation. And usually what catches my attention is the person pictures, what they do, how they present themselves, you know, if they are very outgoing, if they are very adventurous, if they like to travel. Those are the things that kind of get my attention first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How long do you exchange before you meet them in person? Before, how long do you write?
Usually I give myself about a week. I have a window of about a week. So if we haven't initiated anything about a week, I usually tend to just dismiss it completely and just move on to somebody else, I would say.
And where would you go on a first date? And do you consider the first date when you meet them?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
When you meet in person, yes. Mm-hmm. So my usual first date would be, usually it's a walk. I like to walk. That's something that I do a lot. Mm-hmm. So I would usually invite them. Before I used to live in Dallas, there was a specific area where I used to live by a small lake where I would just take every single person I did. We would go on the same lake, take a walk. And then if...
And depending on how fast you walked, you had a sense of if there was a...
Depending on how fast we walk and how quick we do the loop. And if the date was successful, we usually stop by. There was a little restaurant where we stop by to have either ice cream or to have a little drink or something. If it wasn't successful, we just meet back and then just get back in our different cars and then go to...
So if it's not successful, yeah. Successful means I'm not sure I want to see that. I know I don't want to see that person again, right? Is that the idea? Okay.
Yes.
What do you say? What's your opening line and what's your closing line, if there is such a thing?
Usually in person, we wouldn't say much. It's usually after via text that I would say it was a really nice time, but I don't really feel a connection here. So I wish you the best of luck most of the time. And I hate to say this about myself, but sometimes it just organically just fizzle out. Like they don't reach out and I don't reach out.
Mm-hmm. And the opening one? How do you start?
The opening one when we first meet?
Mm, or even before the opening line?
I usually tend to go with a joke, something about what their profile says or something about where they are on a specific picture.
Mm-hmm.
And I would ask them like, oh, is that the Grand Canyon behind you? Or, oh, I didn't know you could swim, something, when they're completely in the water, you know, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's usually the most successful one. Like I usually go in with a joke or just a standard hi.
Ali?
So what is the original question again?
Ah, there've been so many. So, but you can start anywhere. I understood you started dating again after 20 years. So that's, mm-hmm. first of all, differently from Douglas and Louise, that you actually have another experience.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a new culture. This is a new practice. How do you go about it? What do you write on your profile? What captures your attention? What is it that you're looking for when you look? What do your eyes stop at? And then I'll continue. So about, I don't overwhelm you with 10 questions at once.
Sure. You know, even though my experience is really different from Douglas and Louis, like I'm on the dating apps, guys. Like I'm on Bumble and I'm on Hinge. And that is the primary, that is the only way that I've met people to go on dates with this time around. You know, the last time I was dating was in my, you know, early 20s, and, you know, maybe there were Craigslist personal ads back then. But there were no dating apps, you know? And so you really, like, I met people at work. I met people who were friends of friends, or maybe you'd go out and somebody would hit on you. It was that kind of thing. So this was a totally new experience. And now I can't even imagine just like going out at night somewhere with friends and like meeting somebody organically, like in the wild. I'm like, do people even do that? So the things that, you know, I think I'm pretty straightforward in my dating profile about what I'm looking for, but I waffle sometimes. Like I'll, you know, for a few months, it'll say, I'm looking for a long-term relationship or I'm looking for a life partner. And then when that doesn't sort of get me anywhere, then it's like, well, maybe I just want to have fun. And so I might sort of change the messaging on my profile.
Does it change who you, whose profile you then pay attention to?
Yeah. Because I'm looking at things like what is somebody's intention on the on the dating apps. And so then I might change, you know, who I'm looking at or who I might consider. When it comes to the things that catch my eye on other people's profiles, it's always the first thing I'm looking for is like, is there a smile somewhere? Is there a smile in one of the photos? Mm-hmm. Hopefully the first one. And there's like this intangible sort of, there's something about the visual piece that is my first line. And it's not necessarily like, do I find this person extremely attractive? Is, do I get the sort of, this is an kind and open person kind of coming through the photo. And that's like my first line of sorting, I guess.
Mm-hmm. How often have you been surprised when you meet them?
Surprised in what way?
That they're kinder than what the picture showed or that they're less?
I feel like it's 90% of the time it's pretty spot on. And wow. Then I get surprised every once in a while. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what makes you want to go and meet them in real life or in the wild, as you call it? It's like the bonobos.
I think if the communication is there, like there are so many times when I keep waiting and waiting during the texting phase for the other person to just like ask me a question or make a comment specific to my profile. And if it's not happening, it's just, I have zero interest in continuing. But if there's a lot of times, if there's like immediate sort of text, good banter, good back and forth, fun, mm-hmm. Then I'm excited to meet somebody in person.
So then you meet them the first time. And where do you meet?
It's usually like, well, get a drink, like at a bar on the earlier side. So that if either of us wants it just to stay as mm-hmm. like we met for a drink, we can do that. Or if it's going well, then we can sort of extend it and, you know, get some food. It's usually
How do you know and how do you communicate it?
How do I know if I want to stay?
Mm-hmm. And how do you know? It's how do you know if you want to stay? It's how do you know if they want to stay? It's because a lot of these things are sensed more than known, actually. They're physical, but not just physical in the attraction sense. They're physical as in they're embodied. They don't always get articulated in words, but you know when you're curious, you know when you're not in a rush, you know when you suddenly want another drink. Mm-hmm. You sense when there is a kind of a rapport between people. So describe it from what you experience.
Mm-hmm. I actually think that there's like a difference between how well I can tell if I'm interested. I have a hard time knowing if somebody is interested in me that way. Mm-hmm. There's almost always good conversation. I find it really easy to make conversation with people and mm-hmm. I'm curious. I like to learn about them. And for me, the way that it turns in the direction of, oh, I'd like this to be more than just one drink is if they're curious about me. And like you said, there's like, there are things that are sensed if it feels like, you know, in a sort of embodied way, I'm a little bit on autopilot. If I find myself like just naturally like leaning into them, getting a little bit closer, there's like, you know, eye contact and, you know, some natural kind of flirtation going on, then I can tell, okay, I'm into this. Mm-hmm. It's a little harder and it's weird because my last few dates that I've gone on, I've sort of walked away thinking like, that was fun. That was cool. Great conversation. I don't think they were into me. And then they came back and expressed interest. And I was like, oh, that's surprising to me. So I don't know.
And then what did you do? You went back?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll almost always go, like if the first date is fine and if the conversation was good, I'm interested in just talking with people and getting to know them. So I'll almost always go back for a second date.
You said before, my friends are getting tired. I can't imagine them being tired if you tell them titillating stories of your dates. So there must be there are the titillating stories, the fun stories, and then there are the frustrating stories, I suppose. Mm. So how much do you experience, this is to all of you too, your dating life as kind of separate from the rest of your life? It's that thing that you go to, you leave your life to go on a date. You hope that it becomes more than one date. If it lasts long enough, at some point you bring this person into your life. It becomes a kind of a big reveal. I'm seeing someone. You're bringing that person in. It's a very interesting type of dating that is actually quite different from the way things used to be and the way it's done in many of your cultures, where you meet people as part of your life with your friends. It's integrated. And I see all three of you shaking your head. So, and if the date doesn't work out well, you had a fun time with your friends anyway, rather than you come back from a date and you say like, Louis, well, that one was not successful. This one was a dud. This one didn't pan out. This one was just a waste of my time. I mean, you begin to evaluate the dating, in very material ways. I didn't go to do this with my friends. Mm-hmm. I went on this date. It was a nothing. And so then the dating takes on a different value. Now mm-hmm. it needs to compete with what I could have done alternatively. And then, okay, you're all reacting to me visually, so I'm going to be quiet and let you all say what you're thinking.
Oh.
Go ahead, Douglas.
That's a lot. So I understand that what you're talking about is how dating is not integrated into our lives as our norm, but rather it's something that we do separate from our lives. And it's not necessarily fun for that reason. It feels a bit like a chore. It could. And I completely agree with you on this point. But I also try my best to have fun on these dates, right? Even if it doesn't go well, to know that it was a good learning opportunity.
Where do you meet on the first date? Where do you go?
Usually I'm in the Louis boat here. I like to go on a walk. I like to... Nothing too intense, something where you can leave if you need to, and the other person doesn't feel trapped, I suppose. So, yeah, I try not to go for drinks because during the nighttime I'm very tired and drinks make me even more tired. And I feel like that seeps my energy quite a bit. So I like to go on daytime dates, maybe grab a coffee, something like that, or an ice cream. Go to the farmer's market. Those are my favorite ones.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever do an activity, something that you enjoy, like the farmer's market, other activities, things you enjoy doing? What do you do when you're not on a date? What are your activities, for example?
That's the thing. So on my Hinge profile, it says, for our second date, I like to do something active and fun. Because I know for the first date, I would still be figuring this person out and what they like to do. I don't want to bring them straight into the things that I like, just in case that they don't feel comfortable in that environment. For the second date, I'd like to invite them to, depending on what comes up in conversation, I really like to climb, so I might invite them to the climbing gym. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes if we meet during the evening, oh, let's go to trivia night or something, or I've had a really good date where we went to watch a movie, an outdoor screening, and that was really nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just depending on how that first interaction goes.
Mm-hmm. You know, the difference between a bar and a walk, there's many differences, but one of them is that you're moving.
Yes.
And there's a different way to experience presence, connection, even a little bit of the anxiety of meeting a new person when you are in motion versus when you are seated. And when you move, you are side by side. When you are at the bar, you are face to face.
Yeah.
And side by side is a little bit like when people fish, and they say all kinds of things to each other, but they're looking ahead of them. And I'm thinking of that because you used this interesting word. I want to make sure that nobody feels trapped as we are meeting. So this is such an interesting thing. I want to just make sure that there is an exit for everybody. And, you know, so, and I also notice all three of you are on the extrovert side of the continuum. So it's you enjoy conversations. Is that accurate? Did I make a fair assessment?
I say no. I'm going to pretend sorry. If I need to.
Okay, I retract. Yeah, I totally.
Yeah, I'm more introverted. I like being like one-on-one with people, but yeah.
No, because I see your faces. If I saw your faces on the app, I would think outgoing, smiling, warm. I mean, that's what you exude right here on this Zoom thing. So I don't think of extrovert as big amount of people, but more communicating, engaging with someone, showing your curiosity, keeping eye contact, what you were saying, Ali, and things that you enjoy and you know, and they don't create such tension. At least that's how it came across. But I'm happy to tell me about the pretending, Douglas.
I feel like I'm a bit of an introvert and I'm not really that good at making friends quickly or acting in a way such that it would make someone else feel comfortable, essentially. Mm-hmm. So when I'm out in the world and I'm out in social settings, I look at people and I think about the way they interact with me and the things that I appreciate about those interactions, I try to mimic as best as I can.
Such as
just being super enthusiastic about anything in my life. I know genuine curiosity is something that is super attractive and it draws people to you. I'm kind of a cynical person, so I find it difficult to be genuinely curious about anything or everything a person does or says. But I try to think about people in their shoes and be genuinely curious about them. That's one example.
So what elicits your curiosity? How do you turn small talk into a date?
How do I turn small talk into a date?
Mm-hmm.
Assuming that this isn't already a date and we haven't agreed.
Well, the date in this instance is the structure. I picked someone from the app that seemed interesting enough, and I'm going to go and meet them. That's the structure of the date, to see if I actually am really curious, if the plot can thicken from the one-liner to a paragraph to a chapter to more than a chapter.
I see. Well, I can't fake it in that case. Mm-hmm. I actually have to be genuinely curious about this person instead of pretending. And those instances are few and far between, I'm afraid. I'm only attracted to a certain kind of person. So and when I am, it's much easier and things flow and it feels good. But it's difficult to find that.
What kind of person? Or what kind of interaction? Because we are not just attracted to a person or a look. We're also attracted to an interaction. We become more curious because of the curiosity of the other toward us.
Mm-hmm.
Or because of the questions they ask. Or because of the way they talk about themselves. Or because of the way they listen. So there's a whole rapport. There's a whole interaction. In some way, the date is that. I mean, as this is not science, you know, there's many ways to define this thing. But part of what you're saying is, I know how to be polite. I know how to be courteous. And this is back to what Ali was saying. I don't always know for sure if they're interested. I could imagine that when you leave, because of how kind and polite you are, people could think that you're more interested than you are.
Maybe, but I also think that generally people are as kind and polite as I am, and that's how I have felt going on these dates, even if they didn't pan out. Everyone was equally respectful and kind and polite.
Nice.
Yes.
Good. 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 Do you ever stop? Do you ever say, I've had enough? I'm done with this for a while. I need to meet differently. This is tedious, to use Ali's words. I've had it. Or do you have the same energy still that you have had from way back? You're shaking your head, Ali.
The first one. Yeah. I definitely, like, I'll take breaks and I'll pause the profiles and take the apps off my phone, because it just feels really discouraging after a while.
What is the thing that is discouraging? The not meeting a potential partner, or the process itself?
I think it's both. I think I don't know how to separate the two, because I haven't figured out how to meet a potential partner in a different way than using the dating apps. And so, I keep thinking, like, dating apps 2.0 have to be coming sometime soon, because I don't think I'm alone in my frustration.
No. And what would you change?
I don't know. I feel like I could make $1 million if I knew the answer to that question.
$1 million question.
Probably. I mean, there's probably something about being in person with people and meeting, you know, being in the same space, like physical space, as other people.
You speed date?
I haven't tried it. I'm thinking about it, but I haven't tried it yet. Mm-hmm. It's hard to find speed dating events for people in my age range. Mm-hmm. It's for 20s and 30s. And I'm getting close to 50, so mm-hmm. it's hard.
Mm-hmm. What would you change, Louis?
To set a little bit of background here, for example, to me, dating is not tedious. I actually do enjoy dating. And I enjoy the act of just going out and meeting people. I think that's also something that comes from my background and the way my family is. My family, they just enjoy meeting people in general. That's like one big thing about us. So after that, the way I see dating, it's, to me, I'm going into dating not looking for a long-time partner, but I'm going into dating looking for a good interaction, a good conversation, a good moment. So that's kind of, I guess that's kind of what is hurting me sometimes in the long run, because I just go with, you know, with this big smile on my face, you know, with this just excitement of being there, of getting to know somebody that I haven't met before, you know. And
does the word love ever come in for you?
No, actually, no. To me, dating is, it just feels like I'm meeting a bunch of friends. Somebody I can be friends with, somebody I can be partner with, somebody that can, you know, I have no idea. So that's kind of the idea that I set myself into when I go into these dates. Mm-hmm. And I just go and I'm just looking for that, you know, and that's why I'm not really mad about it, because, you know, sometimes I go after one night, I had a really great night. We had some fun. We had some drinks. We walked, we talked, and sometimes it could last a day, it could be a week of talking to somebody and then it fizzles out, or it could be a month, or it could be 2 months, or it could be 3 months, you know. But at the end, I'm always left kind of happy because I got to have that interaction with somebody. But at the same time, I'm just like, okay, I still haven't found the person I'm looking for, you know. But, and then it just repeats the cycle, and I'm like, okay, you know what? Next week will be nice because I'm going to meet somebody just as exciting as that previous person was. And I'm just going to repeat that cycle again and again and again and again. That's kind of how my dating life goes. And my friend asks me sometimes, like, aren't you tired of going on all these dates? Aren't you tired of meeting all these guys? And I'm like, not really. I mean, it's fun. It's nice. You know, I'm having a good time. You know, it's not necessarily the long-term relationship I'm looking for, but it's something kind of. I don't know if that makes much sense. So,
I mean, you know, I'm in a moment of frustration now myself. I have a zillion questions for each of you. You know, I'm thinking it's such an interesting thing. You're talking about dating, but we haven't used the word love once. We're talking about dating. We haven't said the word sex once. You did mention about the fizzling out and the people kind of nobody writes to each other, but, we haven't talked about ghosting. What are doing the ghosting and are being ghosted. So it's interesting that it's the way that the conversation, is framed. Part of what you say is, I don't really get to be so disappointed because I line up the next potential candidate for the week after. And so I keep myself up with the curiosity and the anticipation of the next guy on my screen. But if I stopped the way Ali sometimes stops, I may also kind of get to the shadow side of this and begin to feel the tiredness, the disappointment, the transactional nature of it. And I think part of what has kept the word love out of it is the transactional nature. You know, all of you are emphasizing curiosity because it's the one thing that is not transactional in what we've been describing. This is a different sequence here. But what am I not including here that should be part of our conversation? Is there anything I haven't thought about that you have had on the front of your mind?
Well,
Ali?
Do you want to go first, Ali? I think I've talked enough.
Sure. I'll just briefly say that, like, there's something very different in my experience about dating at this stage of life than when I was dating younger, looking for a life partner, for somebody to, you know, have kids with and have a life with. This is like, I don't have a rule book.
You have children?
I do. I have a 10-year-old and a 14-year-old. Mm-hmm. So, you know, unfortunately, like when I take time to go on a date, it really feels like my time is limited. My free time, my leisure time is limited. And really, like, the person I'm going to meet from the dating app is competing against time that I can spend by myself, which I enjoy, or with my friends, which I love. And so, you know, for me, I feel like I have to be really discerning. I can't just keep like lining up date after date. I don't want to. Like, I have a full life and people that I want to spend my time with. So, you know, meeting a stranger and spending time with them, there's got to be something like that feels worthwhile for me. But like I was saying, like, I don't have a rule book. I'm kind of making it up as I go along. And that's very freeing in a lot of ways because I don't have like my list that I had when I was like 22. But at the same time, I have much less patience for dating than I did 25 years ago. And, you know, something that I keep coming back to is like, I just keep wondering, like, if there's like something inherently incompatible between me and, you know, I date men, I'm heterosexual, like me and men of my generation, I just don't know if it's working. The one long-term relationship I had was with somebody who was 11 years younger than me, and that worked. And I don't know. There's something really odd about dating men my generation where it feels like there's like a cultural mismatch between us. And I don't know.
You don't meet anybody in your life through the kids, through your friends, through other people who have transitioned out of their first relationships or family relationships. And
no, like anybody that I know who, you know, has gotten divorced or transitioned out of their long-term relationships those are women. And, you know, they're my friends. So I'm not going to stay friends with their now exes who are the men. Mm-hmm. I work in a elementary school. It's mostly women around me. And then through my kids, like those are, you know, mostly intact families that I interact with through my kids. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what to do.
You were going to say, Douglas?
Well, something that, well, you just talked about with Ali, is interacting with people who are already in your life rather than strangers who you meet online, right? A lot of this conversation has been centered around meeting strangers who you meet online through the apps. But I'm thinking about meeting people in real life through the friends that we know or existing friends that we have who we might be interested in. I think that's something that's not talked about too much nowadays, just in general, because the dating apps are so prevalent, right? I have people in my life who I'd be very interested in figuring out more about and going out with. It's just difficult to gauge what they think as well in the moments that I spend with them. So, navigating that has been a little bit challenging for me. I'm pretty straightforward. I have asked out some people that I've been friends with. None of them panned out very well. But, yeah.
What am I missing, Louis? What is it?
So one thing that I've experienced is that with dating apps in general, and just like, you know, the world in general, like everything is so close to reach, you know, nowadays. It's so easy to, you know, to meet somebody that's across the world and just like fly when I'm on vacation and go on a date with them. You know, it's so easy to have like, you know, this many people, you know, available, like right in your phone. You know, when you swipe, you know, if it doesn't work in Dallas, you in DC. If it doesn't work in DC, you in LA. If it doesn't work in LA, you know, you're vacationing in Italy for the summer, you know, maybe it might work there or something. That's one thing that I'm not sure maybe people are equipped to deal with, because, and I have faced this issue firsthand, because if it doesn't work here, or if I'm not happy with the result I have here, I'm always happy to just switch. You know, people are always moving all the time. People are always transitioning. So that's something that I think people might want to learn how to manage, or maybe, I don't know, diagnose like what's going on like underneath and why they feel the need to do that, I won't say.
I mean, we could definitely talk another hour together. It's such an important subject at the moment in so many people's lives, done in a way that we are just beginning to understand what it does to us. You know, I think Louis' comment at the end about, you know, what does it do to our sense of self-worth, our sense of self-esteem, of how we feel commodified, not here but there, I don't like it, I switch. To what extent do we treat people sometimes a little bit like we treat products? You know, I drop, I pick up, I examine, I decide, no, not for me. And what does that do to us fundamentally? I mean, and as long as I stay busy, I don't have to think about it, basically. Then I keep, you know, I keep the adrenaline going and I get the dopamine hits. And but when I stop, I may not feel as good about it. And I can't thank you enough, really. I'm really very thankful, very appreciative.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Esther.
Thank you so much for your advice.
It's nice to meet you, Louis and Douglas.
Yeah. Nice to meet
you,
too.
Ali. Good luck.
Good luck to all of you. Yes.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the only person that does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia Namibia has not achieved in the past. Mm. And it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere, countrywide, to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Alrighty, ladies and gentlemen, we have officially come to the end of our program, and I think that we have learned a lot from Esther Perel and the dynamics of preference versus standards and also modern day dating and modern day relationships. So from me, the matriarch, I bid you guys farewell. I love you forever and a day. You are important to moi ce soir, and au revoir, au revoir, au revoir. Voir.